What did it say? Who's won that race?
Más de 15.000 recicladores de basura colombianos se manifestaron en Bogotá este martes contra una ley que otorga el manejo de desperdicios a sectores privados y consorcios extranjeros. Vladimir Carrillo informa desde la capital colombiana.
Durante 50 años, Marta, con su improvisado carruaje de trabajo y esfuerzo, ha vivido de los desperdicios. Ella es una del 1.5 millón de colombianos que derivan su sustento del reciclaje de basuras, oficio que por una ley de la República pasaría a manos de grandes grupos económicos.
Que nos deje trabajar, que no nos mire como delincuentes, como asesinos, porque ellos mismos son los ladrones que nos están mandando a robar.
Recicladores organizados cerraron filas ante la nueva ley.
Los recicladores no estamos entregando nuestros derechos, no vamos a ceder nuestras carretas, no vamos a cerrar nuestras bodegas y estamos en pie de lucha permanente.
La marcha, convocada por más de 60 organizaciones de recicladores de todo el país, se da en momentos en que la alcaldía de Bogotá está licitando el manejo de las más de 7.000 toneladas de basuras que produce cada día la ciudad. Licitación en la que ellos no fueron tenidos en cuenta.
Si quieren ayudar al pueblo, que lo ayuden de verdad, pero que estén aquí diciendo que quieren ayudar y que quieren ayudar a la economía y al medio ambiente sin tenernos en cuenta, qué pena, no les creemos.
Somos más, porque nosotros somos pobres, pero somos dignos del trabajo del reciclaje y nosotros no nos vamos a dejar nunca, primero muertos que descoloridos.
La norma aprobada además prohíbe que los vehículos de tracción animal sean utilizados para el reciclaje, lo que dejaría a José, a su familia y a su fiel caballo carabalí sin sustento.
Ellos nacieron en cuna de oro, nosotros nacimos en un carro federado reciclando, entonces les gusta solo lo de ellos, lo de nosotros que nos muramos de hambre, que no tengamos que trabajar.
Mientras el gobierno le quita el procesamiento de desperdicios a los pequeños comerciantes, las organizaciones de recicladores que asistieron a la marcha denunciaron que la ley favorecería a una empresa de reciclaje de propiedad de los hijos del expresidente Álvaro Uribe Vélez. Vladimir Carrillo, Telesur, Bogotá, Colombia.
Los presidentes de Venezuela, Hugo Chávez, y de Irán, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, firmaron el miércoles en Teherán 11 acuerdos de cooperación que favorecen la alianza bilateral estratégica en cuestiones políticas y económicas. De igual manera, condenaron las políticas hegemónicas y militaristas de Estados Unidos y otras potencias occidentales. Mientras tanto, el líder cubano Fidel Castro volvió a alertar sobre una posible guerra nuclear mundial iniciada por un ataque de Israel o Estados Unidos a Irán.
Cualquier gobierno del mundo está obligado a respetar el derecho a la vida de cualquier nación y del conjunto de todos los pueblos del planeta. Hoy existe un riesgo inminente de guerra con empleo de ese tipo de armas, y no albergo la menor duda de que un ataque de Estados Unidos e Israel contra la República Islámica de Irán se tornaría inevitablemente en un conflicto nuclear global.
El mensaje de Fidel Castro, difundido por la televisión cubana, llamó a evitar un ataque a Corea del Norte o Irán. La organización humanitaria israelí Shalom Akshav, que significa paz ahora, denunció que hasta 600 viviendas de colonos judíos están siendo construidas en tierras palestinas ocupadas de Cisjordania. Dijo que los colonos israelíes construyen a un ritmo más rápido desde que el gobierno levantó la moratoria de 10 meses el 27 de septiembre, lo que significa una burla a los esfuerzos de paz. Las conversaciones de paz reiniciadas entre Israel y autoridades palestinas, suspendidas por más de 2 años, están en riesgo ante la advertencia palestina de retirarse si Tel Aviv no paraliza la colonización en sus territorios. Los palestinos sufren la ocupación israelí por más de 60 años y millones de ellos viven en campos de refugiados en otros países, impedidos de regresar a sus propias tierras.
Hoy son desocupados, estafados, desesperanzados, están buscando la salida, un trabajo para llevarle el pan a sus familias, a sus hijos.
Los invitamos a visitar nuestra página blog en pueblosinfronteras.wordpress.com. donde podrá opinar y encontrar más detalles sobre las noticias que cubrimos en el informativo Pacífica.
Protestando por un futuro mejor, por un país respetado con principio, moral y honor, no aceptando lo que me toca ahora, corre la bola, lucha, trabaja, estudia, mejora, que griten y hablen.
Regresamos a noticias de Argentina, donde un grupo de matones, conocidos como Patota, que serían parte de un sindicato ferrocarrilero, disparó contra trabajadores eventuales que demandaban un contrato laboral. La violencia provocó la muerte de un estudiante universitario que acudió con organizaciones sociales para solidarizarse con los obreros. Se informa de varios heridos. Pepe Fruto reporta desde Argentina.
Una patota del gremio La Unión Ferroviaria asesinó a un estudiante y militante del Partido Obrero que se manifestaba junto a trabajadores despedidos. Todo comenzó cuando empleados de empresas tercerizadas del ex ferrocarril Roca, junto a militantes del Partido Obrero, intentaron cortar las vías en Avellaneda, provincia de Buenos Aires, en reclamo del pase a planta permanente. La patota intentó impedirlo y comenzó un enfrentamiento y luego una persecución a tiros que terminó en el barrio porteño de Barracas con el estudiante Mariano Ferreira, de 23 años, muerto de un disparo en el pecho. Además, fueron heridos de bala una señora, Elsa Rodríguez, de 55 años, que tiene un tiro en la cabeza y está grave, y un joven que se encuentra fuera de peligro, los dos también militantes del Partido Obrero. Los atacados a tiros denunciaron que todo ocurrió con la complicidad de la policía. El relato de Damián Reynoso, compañero de militancia y de facultad del joven asesinado.
La patota de la Unión Ferroviaria baja de las vías, había como un puente, a dos cuadras vemos que empieza a bajar a la calle. Y todo el cordón de la policía se abre, ellos pasan corriendo al malón y bueno, a partir de ahí fue toda una carnicería. Yo era caos, piedras que volaban por todos lados, botellas. Yo veo a Mariano en el piso con la herida, o sea, lo veo tirado, al principio pienso que le habían dado un piedrazo, me le acerco y digo, está bien, y ahí lo estaba como choqueado, y le veo la marca en el tórax y todo el hematoma, ¿viste? Pero acá lo importante es denunciar que hubo una zona liberada de parte de la policía.
Digamos que un equipo periodístico del canal C5N registró imágenes en las que se ve la persecución e incluso dirigentes de la Unión Ferroviaria amenazándolos para que no filmen. Pero inmediatamente producidos estos hechos, se realizó una importante concentración de repudio en la esquina porteña de Callao y Corrientes, y hubo también actos similares en varias provincias. Uno de los trabajadores despedidos habló en el acto en Buenos Aires y así contó la situación de los tercerizados, dirigiéndose, dijo, a la Presidenta de la Nación.
El ferrocarril Roca tiene más de 25 tercerizadas que están explotando a la gente, nos están explotando día a día. Nosotros tenemos un sueldo de 2.500 pesos, cuando un efectivo está ganando 7.200 pesos. A nosotros nos hacen cambiar más de 20, hasta 10 durmientes por día, y ellos cambian 4. Nosotros pedimos el ingreso a planta permanente. Yo te he despedido de diciembre y no puedo entrar a trabajar en ningún lado. Y hoy fuimos a hacer una acción de cortar las vías en Avellaneda, porque la vez pasada fuimos al Ministerio de Trabajo y nos patearon, ingresaron 12 compañeros nomás y más de 100 despedidos, quedamos afuera. Y hoy nos esperaron a patota.
Desde la conducción de la Unión Ferroviaria, el propio secretario general, José Pedraza, emitió un comunicado en el que reconoció que su sector intentó impedir el bloqueo de vías y argumentó que fue porque los usuarios luego atacan a los empleados por la interrupción del servicio. Recordemos que Pedraza fue uno de los dirigentes sindicales que avaló la destrucción del ferrocarril y el despido de miles de obreros durante el gobierno de Carlos Menem. El repudio a lo ocurrido fue casi generalizado. La presidenta Cristina Fernández condenó lo que pasó y prometió trabajar para identificar a los responsables materiales e intelectuales.
¿Qué reflexión puede haber que no puede hacer la más condena enérgica? Y además también el compromiso muy fuerte para identificar no solamente los autores materiales de este hecho, sino también a quienes hayan resultado autores intelectuales, investigadores, una cuestión tan repudiable como la que nos ha tocado vivir a los argentinos.
Y luego de estas declaraciones, la presidenta precisó a través de su cuenta en la red Twitter que el objetivo debe ser encontrar a los responsables tanto materiales como intelectuales sean sindicales o políticos, y sancionarlos, dijo. Mientras tanto, la Confederación General del Trabajo, CGT, emitió un comunicado en el que repudió lo ocurrido y pidió el esclarecimiento y el castigo a los responsables de lo que denominó hechos de violencia. La Central de Trabajadores de la Argentina convocó para hoy a un paro nacional de sus gremios, lo que incluye a los docentes de todos los niveles y a gran parte de los empleados públicos del país. Esta tarde va a haber movilizaciones en todo el país y la marcha central será a las 17 desde Callao y Corrientes hasta Plaza de Mayo en la ciudad de Buenos Aires.
La Cámara de Diputados de Uruguay dio el primer paso para poner fin a una ley que perdonó los crímenes contra la humanidad cometidos por militares y policías durante la dictadura y que permitiría la apertura de nuevos juicios contra represores. Pasada la medianoche del miércoles, la coalición gobernante Frente Amplio dio 50 votos a favor contra 30 de los legisladores opositores presentes. Durante el día, organizaciones sociales se manifestaron frente a la Cámara de Diputados para respaldar la iniciativa. Jorge Vera es uno de los manifestantes que rechazaban la ley de caducidad.
Es inconstitucional, no se compatibiliza con el Estado de Derecho. Entonces, en la democracia no puede subsistir una ley, como yo lo decía antes, inconstitucional. Entonces, por eso estamos movilizados, vamos a seguir movilizados hasta que sea anulada. Es decir, no puede existir una ley que no castigue a los violadores de todos los derechos humanos y de la democracia.
La propuesta para poner fin a la ley que impide juzgar a militares y policías por los crímenes contra la humanidad pasa ahora al Senado. Hemos llegado al final de otra edición del Informativo Pacífica. Nuestro agradecimiento al Foro Argentino de Radios Comunitarias, a Telesur y a la Radio del Sur de Venezuela, a la Radio de la ONU de Estados Unidos y a todos los medios que hicieron posible este programa. A nombre del director del proyecto, Fernando Velázquez, se despide Norma Martínez. Gracias por su atención.
Este y otros programas del Informativo Pacífica pueden ser escuchados o descargados en iPad o en forma tradicional en www.kpfk.org en los archivos de audio.
A los radioyentes de las emisoras que no programan el Informativo Pacífica los viernes, queremos recordarles que la edición del viernes y de todos los días de la semana pueden escucharla en kpfk.org en los archivos de audio.
This may sound strange, but I want to pay taxes. See, I don't drink alcohol or smoke cigarettes. I relax with something science has proven is much safer, marijuana. And I want to buy it somewhere that charges taxes to pay for schools and roads, just like alcohol and tobacco. What do you think should profit? Are schools and roads or drug dealers?
Visit the Marijuana Policy Project Foundation at joinmpp.org or call 1-877-JOIN-MPP.
Hi, this is Michelle Schacht, and you're listening to Freak Radio Santa Cruz 96.3 FM.
And be sure to tune in to Bathrobs Pier's Broadsides. That's with me, Robert North, on 101.1 FM and www.freakradio.org every Thursday night, 6 to 8 p.m. And, of course, every Sunday morning from 9:30 all the way to 1 p.m. If you're game.
Comunitarias y libres de América y Europa. Nuestro agradecimiento a todas las personas que hicieron posible este programa. A nombre del director del proyecto, Fernando Velázquez, yo soy Norma Martínez. Gracias por su atención.
Este y otros programas del Informativo Pacífica pueden ser escuchados o descargados en iPad o en forma tradicional en www.kpfk.org en los archivos de audio.
Eso es estación
Radio Libre, Radio Free Radio Santa Cruz. You're listening to 101.1 FM, 101.1, and that's, unfortunately, it's in English for all you Spanish speakers, so my apologies. Here we go with Bathrob Spears Broadsides, the October 14th, 2010 edition.
Efficiency in progress is ours once more. Now that we have the neutron bomb, it's nice and quick and clean and get things done. Away with the stress and anomaly, but no less valued a property. The sense and war are perfect sense at home. The sun beats down and a brand new day. No more will they catch the day. A sense of still unborn, a big flash of light. It's all been smooth and swift away. It actually has more room to play. I'll put some snow into the pool tonight. Gotta kill, 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 kill the pool. Kill, 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 kill the pool. Kill, 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 kill the pool tonight. Behold the sparkle of champagne. You find the spark to worry again. A life's the dream of human feeling right. James Bond on the screen today. Give it the liberals, it's okay. So let's get tested and go in the night. Oh, all right, kill, 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 kill the poor. 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 Kill, 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 kill the poor.
Kill the Poor compliments, I believe, the Dead Kennedys and Jello Biafra. You are, as mentioned before, tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, www.freakradio.org, and 101.1 FM. In the studio with me is the inimitable, possibly, and not really imitable, no, he's pretty inimitable, Steve Plaich, spelled P as in prison, L as in larynx, E as in eek, I as in eye, C as in candor, and H as in Hellion. Steve Plaich.
Mucho gusto, Don Roberto.
Oh, no, español. Now we're going to get back into the Spanish-speaking approach. Yeah. Actually, on occasion, I have tried to do a bilingual show, very occasionally, actually. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think once I tried that. And it could happen again, possibly with you as translator, Steve.
Yeah, my Spanish is proficient, certainly not fluent.
Proficiente?
Sí, pues, más o menos.
Anyway, I know, Steve, that you just came out of the den of iniquity, the poverty pimp villa, the Potemkin poverty pimpsky land, homeless service center, the HSC. It's actually it's a collection of buildings out of 115 Coral Street at the corner of Highway 1 and Highway 9, which originally involved just the River Street mini shelter. Then that grew to include the mini shelter and a free meal, and that included suddenly the Homeless Community Resource Center, which became the Homeless Service Center. Then they added the Homeless Persons Health Project, and, of course, along came the Rebelli Family Shelter at a cost of, I don't know, $1 million or $2 million, and now we have the Paul Lee Loft added on. So here's this clump of homeless services with essentially no more shelter than there was 15 years ago for homeless people who are looking for emergency shelter. But apparently enough hoop-dee-doo for an open house today between noon and 3.
Hey, gala celebration, 25 years of success and happy trails.
25 years? How the hell did
actually,
they get that?
Actually, I think they said it was 1987, so it was 23, I think.
There has not been a homeless service center there since 1987.
Well, somebody mentioned 1987 on the day yesterday.
Somebody mentioned it, but I'm not sure what they meant, what they were referring to. There was a River Street mini shelter there, which had 14 beds. There were police officers arresting homeless people for sleeping outside.
And how long ago was that?
It was opened in 1987, actually. Thanks to the activism of people who were willing to go to jail and even commit their put their lives on the line with hunger strikes, such as Jane Immler and Linda Lemaster and Shannon Cosamo and others whose names that I don't really know because I wasn't even active in that field particularly at that time. But, yeah. And, of course, they, I'm sure, were not celebrated. Probably the name Jane Immler wasn't even heard.
Linda Lemaster's name was celebrated. I took the tour with her.
Well,
she was prominent today.
She was prominent, but probably not mentioned by any of the poverty pimps who were running the show, right?
Not by name.
So what happened? How long were you there at this
affair? Well, it began at noon and ended at 3, and I got there about 12:15 and stayed until the end. Enjoyable. I got to meet a lot of people who I had not met before, saying Roland Rabelais, who I had not met. Catherine Byers was there, Don Lane. I met Paul Lee. So, and I had an extended chat, in fact, with Monica Martinez about the Robert North suggestion of a receipt program for homeless when all the shelter beds are filled every night.
Not to say Robert North's Tony Madrigal suggestion.
Well, Robert North primarily.
I am, of course, the greatest. We know that. So what was my... Of course, for the people who don't understand what we're talking about...
Yeah, maybe a little background would be good.
Should I give it or would you...
Please, go ahead.
The Homeless Service Center has a program called the Paul Lee Loft, which... there used to be a thing called the Interface Satellite Shelter Program, which you could come line up every night and get a bed, maybe, if you were lucky. During the summer, it was increasingly unlikely, and for the last, actually, decade... You weren't likely to get a bed any time between April 15th and November 15th because during that time there was only like 20 or 30, sometimes maybe 40 beds in the Interface Satellite Shelter Program, which was a convoy system to various church floors. There were not beds, they were mats on the floor. And they were taken up with disabled people, elderly people, regulars who were there. So instead, the Homeless Service Center during that period of time would give you a letter if you came in with a ticket saying there was no shelter, and you would take the ticket and the letter to the judge or the commissioner, often Commissioner Basket, and she would say, eventually she began saying, okay, ticket dismissed. So that was a procedure they used. However, the law was changed around the time Peace Camp 2010 started, actually a month or two after, but the policy at the Homeless Service Center was changed to state that they would not give you a letter unless you were on their waiting list, even though waiting lists have a length of time for 4 to 6 weeks for men and 2 to 3 weeks for women. So it didn't really matter if you were on a waiting list or not. Almost invariably, there would be no beds available for you on that night. So if you got a ticket that night, the question might arise for a person looking in, well, if there's no shelter... And they're going to call you a personnel person from the Homeless Service Center into court to testify that there is no shelter, which means that the ticket will be dismissed. Why don't you just issue a letter? Well, they stopped issuing those letters. Apparently, well, perhaps you can throw some light on it. Maybe you got Steve Clark to come clean that it was an attempt to smash Peace Camp 2010. And perhaps this caller has the answer. Hey there, caller. You're on Free Radio with Uncle Robert and Uncle Steve.
Robert, we'd really like to hear Steve talk.
Oh, come on. It's not important. And I think we've had enough of that. You actually were listening to a previous show. That was last week's show, a week ago on the 10th. It was actually a week ago on the 14th. Today is the 21st.
And welcome to Bathrop Spears Broadsides, 12 minutes late in the studio with me. I know it may seem like a bad dream or a flashback, but it is Steve Plaich, the man who is not going to make it in City Council, but is insisting that he is running for City Council. Hi, Steve.
How are you? Good morning. Good night. Good evening.
Good evening it is. And yes. I know that, you know, we were, you know, since that chatty little call from Uncle Dennis, who will presumably be in the studio again tonight, did cut into what we were talking about last week. But what we were talking about last week is really still pertinent, particularly since Tuesday evening you attended a forum by the Santa Cruz neighbors at the community room of the police station, where the very same Monica Martinez, executive director of Poverty Land, the Potemkin Village out there at the Homeless Service Center. Let's call it the Homeless Service Center. That's what it is. She's the executive director, and she and I guess a number of other speakers, like a former Homeless Service Resource Center, but now SCPD, FLAC, cover guy, sergeant, or is he simply an officer, Eric Seeley?
I think they refer to him as officer, but I'm not really sure.
Yeah, he was there on Tuesday night before last, and they were chatting before an audience of even more right-wing hostile people. I mean, my sense of Monica and Eric Seeley, and I guess, I don't know what Christine Sipple had to say. I'm more sympathetic to her, Homeless Persons Health Project person.
She was terrific, absolutely.
Yeah. Generally, I haven't got any specific complaints about her, but the problem, of course, that I mentioned with Monica Martinez, as you heard in this prior show, is that she is refusing to document the obvious and to state it, which is that there's no shelter 8 months a year for homeless people who come and walk in, because the Pauley Loft has only a waiting list with rare exceptions, and they've changed their policy to require you to actually be on that waiting list before they will give you a simple letter documenting the fact, if you walk in with a ticket that says that they didn't have shelter that night. So I know that I'd hope that you would go actually tonight to the Homeless Service Center's Board of Director meeting, which meets once a month, and which actually you went to. You haven't been to one of their Board of Directors.
I have not.
It's no great shakes. I was at one 2 months ago. I'm trying to remember how I handled the show. I must have given it to someone else at the time because it conflicts. It's a Thursday night meeting. At that time, I, Ed Fry, and Linda LeMaster asked the question that for 2 months has remained, well, dodged, ducked, stonewalled, denied, which is, you know, let's be honest here. There's no shelter. Let's admit it. Give us documentation that there's no shelter and start there. I mean, you don't have, you know, if we go further, if you and others can get the police department not to issue tickets, if you can get the city attorney to dismiss them, that's good. But we want the basic facts clear for the community so that the media will stop schmoozing us, the mayor will stop lying to us, or if they do lie to us, they'll be confronted with the evidence from the Homeless Service Center that they are, in fact, not telling the truth. There is no shelter, so why are they issuing tickets that criminalize homeless people at night for doing what they have to do, which is to sleep? And I don't know what they're happening. I assume the Homeless Service Center is having its usual board meeting, because I'm not aware that any homeless activists or even homeless advocates, or I'm not quite sure what you would call yourself, Steve. What would you call yourself?
I would consider myself a homeless advocate. I've certainly been so during the campaign.
Uh-huh. And you've stated that you are the only only candidate running who actually opposes the current sleeping ban law.
And that has been reported more than once. In fact, just about every interview that I do, or every forum that we attend, or every newspaper article you see, I'm identified as the only candidate who opposes the sleeping ban and the camping ban, and I do.
Right. And, you know, you've not only done that, but you've spent a lot of time attending trials, going to meetings with city council members such as Byers and Lane, who are the cover folks for maintaining this law, although...
Working feverishly on the Robert Norris appeal.
And you're working on the appeal. You actually brought me the documentation that you filed an appeal in what's called the Norris Facer Sing Song 2 case. Probably not for Sing Sing, but more like Sing Song, for singing the song Downtown with homeless lyrics outside the bookshop Santa Cruz on January 6th and offending a member of the public, Sean Riley, mm-hmm. who was trying to sleep during the day at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and apparently decided that he wanted to give us tickets.
But back to what you're saying about Tuesday night,
anyway,
and you, as you pointed filed. That out, the fact that there are no
spaces available, emergency shelter spaces, was conspicuously absent from that meeting, from that gathering. Most folks just were interested in, well, how come we're offering all these services? How come we're a homeless mecca? How come everybody's coming from all over the country to avail themselves of our homeless services? Why isn't there some way to drive the homeless out of town? That was the substance of the comments, I think, if you distilled them down to a couple of hours of a presentation by Monica Martinez about generally the homeless services. Christine, of course, HPHP was excellent. And then the neighbors themselves were just unhappy with the fact that we have this wonderful program that we're offering to people. And one of the questions was asked was, who qualifies for these services? Do you have to be a resident of Santa Cruz to qualify for the services? What criteria do they use? And it was pointed out by Monica that you don't have to have any criteria. You have to simply be here.
Right. And that, of course, is something that I note. I'm sure the new council members will be pressured to change because there's this fantasy that there are these wonderful gold-plated services that everyone is rushing to use in Santa Cruz. And, in fact, the reason people come to Santa Cruz has little to do with the homeless services. It has to do with the connections they have with the people in the town, the climate of the town, the cultural quality of the town, the previous connections that they've had there, and so forth. And that it also might have to do if you were with the possible jobs, but there aren't any jobs in Santa Cruz, so I don't think that's relevant. As for housing, the housing really sucks in Santa Cruz, so that's not a factor either. It's just not true, either in Santa Cruz or elsewhere, that I've seen, although I may be simply repeating litany here, and I would like to get some documentation either way. If you have information on either side of this question, please give a call. Phone number here for this show is 427-3772, area code 831-427-3772. As to why cities, if cities attract homeless people, and if so, why they do, one of the reasons that Santa Cruz got homeless people in 1995, and there was a large thing called the Coral Street Open Air Shelter at that time, which was a sort of a tent city that ran for 6 or 7 months and then became denounced by then Mayor Rotkin and Vice Mayor Kennedy, was that San Francisco was driving out homeless people under Mayor Jordan and the Matrix program, making it very hostile, and so Santa Cruz was nearby. We do have a caller. Hi, you're on Free Radio with Robert and Steve.
Hello, this is Bob Patton.
Hey, Uncle Bob, or should I say battle-weary Bob Patton?
No, this is battle-ready Bob.
Ooh, beautiful.
Calling from
love
the front lines of the battle for the Veterans Memorial Building.
Well, Bob, I know that you are also a veteran of the sleeping ban struggles. You were one of the co-founder of the Human Rights Organization, which for a decade or more fought for against the sleeping ban on the downtown ordinances before you finally succumbed to economic necessities and exhaustion and moved into other areas. You've also been a vet for years trying to fight for vets' rights, and some of those vets are homeless. And you've been prominent in the struggle to reopen the Veterans Hall.
Wow. I'd like to have that on my obituary. That was really good.
Well, it may come sooner than you think, Uncle Bob. Time is rolling on.
Bob, what's the status of that Veterans Hall now?
At this time, the building remains closed. We have, I'm sure most people know, we have a lawsuit, the Veterans Advocate Group here in the county called the United Veterans Council has filed suit against the county saying that they basically overreacted and that the sky is falling mentality on life and limb and danger indeed does not exist. So our first attempt was to find out if it was necessary. So we brought in two additional engineers, one a structural engineer and the other a historic expert on building. Both of them concur with our belief that the county overreacted. So the status of it is it's still closed. We don't have access to it, so which means we are the veterans that were residents there, which was the Veterans of Foreign War, which is VFW, the Disabled American Veterans,
uh-huh,
which is the DAV, and the American Legion, all very established veterans organizations, have been in there since as early as 1939.
33 or so, 39 maybe it is.
Now, now Bob, back in, I'm sorry, Steve wanted to ask something, but I'm going to, of course, barge in my usual manner. You know, back in March is when you had your own engineers say, what is this crap? There's just a little bit of the front of the building on us on one particular area that was, you know, that crumbled, and it had nothing to do with the habitability of the entire building. That was my understanding of what the engineer found that you guys hired.
Correct. And the second engineer came in who was a historic expert, and he said the same thing, that there's no need to close the building down. All repairs could be done while residents, while still there were people residing in the building, just needed to be secured, scaffold. Only the work that was being done would only cause direct drop in a small drop zone. So with a scaffolding there and appropriate security, there'd be no reason people using the building would be in danger.
Yeah, Bob, as you know, I'm a candidate for city council, so I talked to an awful lot of people, and they always ask me, what's up with the vets building? And the thing that puzzled me initially was when I went over there, it was posted closed by the county's chief executive officer, and I'm wondering whether or not the Veterans Administration has any jurisdiction over that whatsoever.
None whatsoever. The ownership of the building lies with the county. They are bound to, by contract, under the California Veterans, California Military and Veterans Code, the number I don't have right in front of me.
Mm-hmm. You know, but that was March, Bob, and you know what I said then, just get the damn vets to you know, simply open up the building or camp out in front of the building or do some kind of sit-in in the offices, and you or somebody else said, oh, no, we've got to take the legal approach. Let's wait month after month after month. And, of course, the building decays, the public interest evaporates, and I guess you're getting a brief spike in public interest because this story on the second section of the Santa Cruz Sentinel, and the one you mentioned has been going on for a couple of days, vets meals canceled despite county offer. The traditional Thanksgiving and Christmas, twice a year we feed you real fat. The rest of the time you stay, you know, outdoors with no shelter. You know, fuck you. You get sleeping band tickets. I've always thought that's kind of a, you know, I mean, I thought it's very nice to have these twice a year celebrations, and I'm often there, you know, handing out flyers and taking people's accounts. But I always thought it was kind of a, you know, gold trimming on the slime, so to speak. But the fact is, this has now, you know, become a focal point, at least for the Sentinel, because it makes us realize it's November, or it's October, and November coming up, and they're still babbling, the vets are still talking and babbling, I'm sorry, about going to court instead of actually doing what vets are supposed to do. You know, shoulder arms, guys! Get your rifles and head for the vets hall! What do you think, Bob?
Well, that's all good sentiment. You know,
I'm a nonviolent guy myself, of course.
I would be pleased to see things come back to normal where we could have the community down there with various around the event. The feeding event always brought in a lot of other community members, including yourself and myself, down there advocating for rights around the sleeping ban and trying to bring information about the ridiculousness of the Santa Cruz City's laws against, you know, the homeless.
But it's the closure of the vets building itself for the last, I don't know, since February, whenever they closed it.
January,
thank you. And that itself, it denies not just veterans a lot of a significant resource in the community, but members of the community. I mean, I know we had to, you know, sell our souls to Tim Bratton in order to use the bathroom to get in there in the old days, but that was being kind of worked on, was it not? I mean, Bratton was kind of slowly being forced into a corner, being forced to acknowledge at least the rights of homeless vets, if not the rights of the public and the rights of the vets generally.
Yeah, can I ask about, Bob, do you have any sense of how many homeless vets there would be in the city of Santa Cruz?
Well, there's a gentleman that works for the Veterans Service Center, and he estimates that there is probably about a 14-18% of the male population is homeless vets. And those homeless veterans kind of fall through the cracks, even though there's multiple types of outreach to them. either are not capable of following through on their on advocating for their needs, or there's not enough services to help them get through the sometimes ridiculous loops of the system. So that has really impacted our ability. I'm talking about the veterans organizations that all of them have what's called service officers that are elected, and they are part of the outreach to incoming people. Either walk in or we go out and look for veterans or try to respond to veterans that others see that are in need. So at this point, we've lost that capability, and I'm glad you asked that question, because the existing county service office for veterans had a very nice storefront right there in the, on the main floor of the building. It was very friendly. There was a lot of literature and help there.
Yeah, it seemed to be very prominent, yeah.
Now they've been moved up to Emmeline, a secure area, because all their documents have to be kept in a secure zone, where the patient, the veteran patient, or the veteran person, not even a patient, but needs some assistance, has to pick up a phone on the outer wall and then ask for an appointment, and they call them back sometime that week. So that really did impact not just the veterans that were housed in that area, but the veterans throughout the entire county. And that's one of our primary interests, is to get that back in a street, in the street level storefront there in the Veterans Memorial Building. And if we win this suit, that'll be the first lights to come on. Excuse me, I'm just going to.
Wonderful.
Well, I don't know, wonderful. I mean, the fact is we've been waiting for this one for months and months. I heard this was going to be dealt with in April, and we're now in October. And the fact is that if, while people don't do anything, and again, I'm not done anything, so I guess. But frankly, if the vets had asked you to call to the community for people to come down there, and let's say Peace Camp 2010 set itself up in front of the county building, and people came there, and for a month they provided, you know, shelter for a whole bunch of homeless people, a safe and legal sleeping place with a porta potty to boot, where people could actually take a dump, in a city that has no restaurants at night, restrooms at night, a couple of restaurants, but not many restrooms. So, you know, I don't understand. I guess you probably have raised the issue with the vets of why not actually, you know, do some real, you know, high profile protesting, if not to mention reoccupation of the building. And the answer was, oh no, we're gonna wait for the attorneys, right?
That was not quite like that. You know, the body of the pot of veterans is pretty much boiling. I mean, you can't politicize and then marginalize a group of men who understand, you know, what life's about. So, but the general body is smart enough to assign people to deal with the legal aspect of it, and they take their counsel, so that boiling pot has a lid on it. However, you know, that's where I am right now as the president of the United Veterans Council. I have to keep everybody informed and everybody on task to get at least to and through the trial. Starts on the 15th. We've got expert witnesses and a jury trial. So nobody likes the government, and looks like, you know, we are getting plenty of story told right now, and the memory won't fade. I mean, there's two sides of every story. I think Curtis did a fairly good job of presenting it. You know, it makes everybody look a little bad on both sides. So,
Curtis Alexander, yeah. The Sentinel you're talking about.
Yes.
And today's
Sentinel.
And
the stories before, they're a little bit convoluted and not truly factual, but, you know, bad press is better than no press.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, again, this trial that's happening, am I wrong in thinking that it was supposed to happen in the spring?
You're right. And what happened was, first the county tried to deny us a jury trial. Then they disqualified the judge that was first benched, or, you know, put on the bench for this trial to start on the date it had been determined it was going to start on. Well, that left us with having to make a decision whether we wanted to continue on the starting date with a only bench that was open was with a Judge Conley, who's new. Nobody knew her.
Rebecca Conley? Yeah.
Yeah. And she, so everybody said, well, we'll go with a judge we know, which doesn't have an opening until the 15th of November. And
who's that judge?
It went out of my mind.
Maragonda? Gallagher?
No,
Burdick?
No.
Haddock?
No. It's a young judge. He's a veteran also. I think it starts with an L. But
don't know.
I'm sorry about that. I just had a brain drain. I might think of it.
I just think waiting for these legal maneuvers, although the Santa Cruz, you know, I mean, it is true that peace
camp. Wait, am I hearing Robert Norris say this? Waiting for legal maneuvers? How many cases you got going right now?
That's not what I wait for, though. I'm not on the radio waiting for legal maneuvers. I'm on the radio trying to encourage people to take action before we have to wait for expensive attorneys that most people can't afford, and attorneys who will eventually disappoint most of us anyway because of the nature of the courts. So
well,
I don't have a lot of faith in the courts, and I don't think you should either. But
well, no, I don't have faith in anything really. I'm my own
faithless one,
and when I have strong feelings about something, as you know, I try to advocate for some resolution in that situation too. So I'm not. And you know I'm not unfamiliar with this kind of situation.
Right. Well, I remember going to some retreat with some vets with you once. And I mean, I just find the entire attempt to deal with Bratton, which is the guy who was, for those who don't know, what was his official position? He was
manager
of the building, and he was gradually squeezing out the vets and squeezing in the yoga meisters and essentially trying to turn the whole thing into a profit-making activity for a different group, and also engaging in anti-homeless-type behavior by removing benches from outside the vets' hall and making it difficult for people to access the public facilities and harassing homeless vets and all kinds of other things. I heard, you know, year after year, I heard, you know, vet spokespeople, Larry, Roger, you name it, whoever they were, explaining that they had written a letter of protest to the governor, you know,
yeah.
And I thought that was going to make some fucking difference.
No, that guy's gone.
It doesn't matter. He took the vets all with him.
Oh, he
That's
did.
That's the point. You know, he closed the vets all. That's what I heard, in essence, that some of his behind-the-scenes machinations was in part responsible for the vets all. Is that true? I don't want to give Tim a fair shake here.
No, absolutely. I agree with you. The Board of Trustees is trying to recover the skeleton of the dilapidated and dysfunctional former Board of Trustees is finding that he has taken some possibly gravely illegal actions in destroying or now hiding intellectual properties that belong to the Board of Trustees when it comes to records that were electronically stored. And, maybe I shouldn't go any further, but the Board of Trustees, the new one, is considering taking legal action.
Aha, legal action is being considered.
Anyone prominent in the community on the Board of Trustees?
Let's see. We have
Pat
Jasmine
Clark,
Burke,
perhaps?
Jasmine Burke, who is the head medical person for the... Oh, what is the name of there? It's a...
Is Pat Clark on the board?
No, absolutely not.
He was before, though, right?
It's an acupuncture and alternative health area here.
Uh-huh. The five branches?
Five branches.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, yeah. So there is Gil Sanchez, who's an architect. There is Terry McKinney, who is one of the employees with the city utilities.
Uh-huh.
There is John Flynn, who's the retired and the current commander of the VFW post at 7th Avenue. They have their own building and a bar, even.
Yeah, how about that?
Well, let's leave this litany, which I know is scintillating and, you know, getting us all rather excited. But let me just, you know, ask what can people do to support the vets in this situation?
I guess, you know, we could try to get a report closer November 15th when the trial finally begins. And then we'll get a couple of appeals. In the meanwhile, the vets will send their asses and do absolutely nothing but wait for their attorneys. And the vets all will remain locked. I mean, that to me is just very frustrating and gives me a chance to rage at you, who are, of course, a fine activist and aren't really to be blamed for any of this.
Well, I mean, you always put on a good, you know, you always put on a good show when you do this, so nobody can really hold it against you.
Thanks.
I'm always appreciate being roasted by you. So.
Well, I can't really roast you because I think you would be sympathetic to these kinds of direct actions if there was any support for them. The problem is that, you know, people are just as with the war. They're hiding in their houses rather than challenging the Obamatons and the increased, you know, escalation, which is being, you know, dismissed under terminology like the surge, which actually means simply reinforcing defeat that's going on overseas, and not just defeat, but, you know, mass murder that's happening every day. And we don't get people, you know, we're more concerned about the economy and Meg Whitman and Jerry Brown and all that sort of shit. So I'm... the vets aren't the only group that isn't concerned about these issues, so I'm not, you know, it's not fair to completely slap you around as a vet, and particularly since you're an activist vet. So keep activizing. We're talking with Bob Patton, who can be reached. You can find ways to support the vets' lawsuit to reopen the vets' hall at where and when and how. How can you? What's info on that?
Oh, I'm going to have to go get the flyer now. Hang on a minute. You make me go back in the house.
Okay.
I guess what I would like to encourage, you said, what can the community do? I mean, right now we're looking to see any letter writing to supervisors, or since there's a lot of the hoopla around the current articles that came out in the paper.
Well,
let me find something to at least
let me go to that one.
Keep that flowing.
I mean, that really was the issue that originally brought this 20 minutes ago, and I asked you to call in on that issue, which is what is this that the vets, now they've been given the Civic Auditorium kitchen to do some cooking, can't cook up a meal after, you know, in 3 weeks hence, or a month and 3 weeks hence? I mean, come on, after the earthquake, Jane Immler was cooking up meals the night after the earthquake and feeding people. What the hell's going on here? You got incompetent cooks? I mean, you need people to, you know, what's going on? Why can't the vets get it together?
Hey, well, come on now. The elves for Santa Claus worked all year just for one day.
Okay,
so,
I got you.
There you go.
Well, you better be
you're made homeless and all your efforts had been around the ambience of the building, the entire setup of the volunteer organizations that came in started in late August. It was whipped up in September.
What was whipped up?
The getting the people on board when it comes to
the volunteers,
the bakers and
the butchers, the bakers,
and all that,
the turkey trimming makers, that sort
of
thing.
There's a whole committee that does that. There's a whole portion of our finances that is dedicated to that. And actually, there are state regulations that if we're calling it a veterans meal in the sense that we have been doing it in, then we may be in jeopardy of losing some support, or maybe not violating, but it's not considered appropriate to then go to and find or promote something outside of a veterans establishment that has the veterans' names on it. So it's the VFW post itself is the one. The Bill Motto post is the one that for 25 years has put this on.
And you're saying that the reason they can't do it is primarily because that they need another month and a half to get volunteers together? Is that the deal? Or?
Well, it's not just a one- or two-day thing. It's a whole thing that goes on for many months, and they just stop being out of the building. This is where a lot of the pots and pans, the tables, the chafing dishes, they would have control of what was going on when it came to the cooking, the movement of materials back and forth. It's all been very established.
Okay, well,
let me go to somebody else's place, whatever it be, you're going to have to follow their rules and regulations.
Well, I know that at the Civic,
the amount of effort it would take to try to comply with their efforts and meet our deadline just did not match.
I just know that after the earthquake, 2 days after the earthquake, they were feeding hundreds of people in the Civic Auditorium.
Well, that's an emergent situation.
Well, I think sometimes
they can suspend public health regulations in emergent situations.
Well,
this is simply not one of those emergent situations.
There's no mention made of public health regulations.
Certainly, anytime you're preparing food, that's what Bob was saying when they had that facility with all the pots and pans cooking this and that. Now they're taking it somewhere else.
Public health regulations require. If they agreed to suspend public health regulations, would that help you, Bob? I don't think so, Steve.
That's
bullshit, as usual here. I mean, I got to tell you, I mean, it's nice to schmooze it up and then propose possible excuses for this situation, but.
You didn't give him a chance to answer.
You're the one who answered for him. Steve's your advocate, right, Bob? Is that the deal?
Absolutely, I can.
Yeah. I don't think it doesn't sound like there's an excuse here, Bob, but if you got one, let's hear it on the next minute and a half because I'm going to roll on this show here.
Okay, well, instead of making excuses because, you know, there's just sides to this. I'm trying to move through and get this over with and have the best outcome possible.
Right, well, how can people help to open the vet's hall, which I think is probably more important, if not more important than these two meals?
The information I'm going to give you.
Well, tell you what, when you find it, Bob, why don't you call me back and we'll put it on the air.
It's here right now.
Okay.
One more. Just bear with me now unless you've got... hottie calling in.
Hey, listen, every call is a hottie call for us. By the way, you're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, freakradio.org. My name is Robert Norris. In the studio with me is that city council candidate, Steve, what's your name again?
Steve Plaich for city council.
Steve Plaich, that's it. See if you can think of something that rhymes with Plaich. It's going to be real hard.
It's like orange or something.
Like orange, yes.
Well, the folks probably should know that starting probably in early December, we'll be doing our annual caroling.
Oh, yeah? Who's we?
You and I.
Oh, I see. This is new to me. Okay, well, I suppose you're ready to deal with the unreasonably disturbing noise citation?
Chestnuts roasting on open fire? That'll be your chestnuts.
Councilman roasting on open fire.
That is nice.
All right, so, Bob, you
have
a chance.
How about downtown? You could have a jingle bell.
We got lots of lyrics for our time, but have you found your thing yet?
Yes, I did. And,
what do you got?
Actually, the contact number is the United Veterans Council. Because we're homeless, the organizations there do not any longer have their own phone number. So this is a centralized. It's a voicemail. I'll check it every morning, and I'll get to or direct people to the appropriate information. And that number is 831-425-3340.
Right.
425-3340.
Okay, 425-3340 if you want to help out the those
get
those struggling vets.
We can get back to you.
And there will be a meal on Thanksgiving at the Civic Center?
No, we have not.
The Veterans of Foreign Wars put this on had a press release that said unfortunately they were not able to do a meal because of the closure of the building.
But it could be that the Plaich for City Council Campaign 2012 will do a special memorial meal for five people.
See Coonerty. He's the one that says he got the Civic Center for a couple days. So I don't know. Everybody can just sit on the theater seats and dribble their food all over the place.
Well, we'll see what happens. We're talking with Bob Patton of the... Bill Motto Post? How would you describe yourself?
I'm a member of the Bill Motto Post, but my current position that I feel is the most important is I'm president of the United Veterans Council of Santa Cruz County. We're the ones that are pressing the lawsuit to reopen the building sooner than later.
And denying the poor and hungry people of Santa Cruz their Thanksgiving meal. You could at least provide box lunches anyway.
Well... come and talk to me about that. Maybe if you start up a fund, I'll at least go down
bananas
there.
Bananas for Thanksgiving. Yeah. That could be our motto.
It's just that the Bill Motto's decided they're not going to do their traditional meal this year. But that doesn't mean veterans can't get involved in other stuff.
Fair enough.
There's a lot of other ideas.
What about a revolutionary movement to overthrow the war criminal government?
Now, Well, we'll leave that up to someone else.
I am as afraid of that. All right, well, thank you, and next time, Bob.
Okay, thanks, Robert.
Thanks a lot. And phone lines are open, 427-3772. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz. We will be having a special benefit on Saturday, day after tomorrow, at the Secret Cafe. And I'm going to actually tell you where it is.
Holy cow.
We don't normally reveal these things on the air, but it is going to be, are you ready?
Very quietly now.
It's going to be at the Chavez House at 316 Main Street. Ah, that could be the FBI. Let's see who's calling it. Hi, you're on Free Radio with Steve and Mark.
Hey, jingle bells, the mayor pretends there's a public bathroom on SoCal, but it's a pretend one because there's you can't get in there, man. I tried, man. Santa Claus can't get in there.
Is that our good friend Drum Circle Dave?
I think it's Drum Circle Dave. Hey there, DCD.
Yeah, there's a pretend bathroom on SoCal and Pacific. It's all pretend.
A Potemkin bathroom, perhaps? Mm-hmm. A Potemkin pot?
It's a pretend veterans hall. You can go down there and pretend it's there. You can just pretend
that the mayor is doing
his job. I'm pretending. He's been doing his job.
Now, wait a minute. Drum Circle Dave, are you referring to the bathroom that's in the parking garage that used to be open? And
yeah, man, the ones that I have to go to when I get through with my bike ride. I ride 5 miles, and I depend on that bathroom, man, because, you know, when you get off your bike, man.
Oh, brother.
And Steve is nodding in agreement.
Find another bathroom, you know, but
so what do you mean it isn't open? What news do you have about this place?
It's under construction. It's been under construction for a month. It's the Chinese New.
Well, they're trying to build a better bathroom. And what's your problem there?
New, but it's the Chinese New.
You know, I should advise you, for all you upscale listeners, that there is New Leaf Market across the street, which if you pretend to be a customer, you can walk up to the front and say, "Oh, please, give me a token so I can go pee pee," and they will let you use their bathroom.
Mayor of Santa
Cruz. Well, actually,
yeah,
I've been able to get tokens.
Pretend to be Sergeant Arms and on the police department. Pretend to be the gnome.
You know, don't give up your day job, Dave, but I want to say that there are two bathrooms that are open and during the day, for those who are interested, within a block of the, apparently, as you claim, it's the closed SoCal garage bathroom. One of them is the Osamo tea room, which is a visitor's bathroom, which is on, I guess it's Lincoln Street. As you head toward the farmer's market, it's open. It's a visitor's bathroom. And also Pizza My Heart has a visitor's bathroom. The reason you can tell this is there's a little sign out front that says visitor's bathroom, which means you don't have to buy their damn products in order to go in to take a dump. The city is paying them to keep those places open. So,
but still, man, for the guy like me, man, has got a bicycle, needs to park, lock it up, you know, maybe I got to take a long one, but the thing is, man, they should have, like Ed Frey had at the Peace
Fry,
Camp, the Ed little porta potty says, you know, men and women, you know, they're real easy, the city can afford it. If they can afford to gold plate that damn bathroom, man, it's been closed for a month.
More
they
than
can
not,
park
actually.
Two porta potties out front, man.
Well, Dave, aside from the bathroom complaints,
yeah,
do you have anything
right.
else
yeah,
you wish to shout into the microphone at us?
The fence is gone from the vets hall and the mall and all that stuff. It's just gone, man.
Well, I know. We have the usual concerns about the missing
the
culture.
Pretending to be gone.
What happened with the drum circle yesterday? I should say the drum Congo line. How did that go?
Oh, man, the mayor should be there. We'd drum for him. I'd have something to drum him up. Man, I'd drum him all the way back to his little hovel in that big old building down there with the antennas on it.
Well, Mike Rotkin will be leaving office next month, so you will have Ryan Coonerty to drum.
Kick him out, and another puppet takes his place. Coonerty, right?
Ryan Coonerty, that's correct.
Oh, Ryan, man. Damn it, man. Look, man, this town used to be compassionate. It used to be hopeful. It used to be the best. The Changeling, you know, have you ever heard of The Doors? You know, there's a song they got. You should listen to it, man.
Drum Circle Dave, any reports that are actually factual and specific about the last few days, like the Drum Circle, anything happened that you want to let us know about?
No, it's still going on. We're being left alone. We're policing ourselves. We do our own little, you know, motto, you know, that, you know, this land is your land, my land, you know. Made for you and me, that kind of thing, you know. But then the mayor's over there, and man, he's just, no, he's pretending, man.
So wait there.
Wait a minute. You mean Mike Rutkin actually showed up at the drum circle? That sounds unlikely.
No, he's pretending.
I was with
That's
Mike
all
Rutkin.
He does.
Now, Steve claims that he was
just pretend
with,
checks. He,
well, I want to thank you for the update, Drum Circle Dave.
And you guys are for real. I know you're not pretending. So, hey, you guys have a good night. And please, man, get in there and tell them the truth. No
thank you, Dave. You bet to believe it.
Thank
all
you.
All right, Dave. Bob. And Drum Circle Dave, of course, will be joining us during the Christmas holidays for the Robert North Christmas Chorale, which will be touring downtown probably all during the holiday season.
I hadn't heard about that. Mm-hmm. I guess I have to check with Norris. Oh, wait. No, I am Norris.
Yes, you are Norris. And I think, didn't Bob Patton commit to being a member of the Robert North Christmas Chorale?
For some time. Now, we were talking before the phone calls began to pour in about an issue that you have began some investigation of the other night, and you reported on at the Huff meeting, our little Huff meeting yesterday, at the which we have every week, at the Abbey Cafe, where there is free coffee for those who actually get to the meeting. Come on, folks, you can do it. That's at 10:30 every Wednesday morning, Abbey Cafe, which is at the Vintage Faith Church at Highland Mission and High Streets. And you mentioned that the evening before that, two nights ago, you went to the Santa Cruz Neighbors Bigots Gala, which featured a presentation by the cover-up schmooze Potemkin Povertycrats, Monica Martinez, Eric Seeley, and Christine Sippel, and let's put it a little less baldly and say homeless service center personnel and the Homeless Persons Health Project person, who were trying to explain to the community what homeless services did, who they served, and you seem to you before the Bob Patton called in. You pointed out, Steve, that, and you pointed this out at the Huff meeting the other day. That, you know, that the point was made. A question was asked. Well, you know, don't you have to be a resident to get, you know, services? And why isn't that the case? And as though it were some crowning victory, I guess Eric Seeley or maybe it was Monica Martinez said, no, you don't have to be a resident to get homeless services. And since they're getting government money, you probably couldn't even put in a residency requirement, but I don't know. Maybe they could. But to me, it's that, of course, is, again, it's like, again, you know, designing a better shuffleboard on the sinking ship. That is to say, what's really needed is to examine what services are actually provided in terms of essential life-preserving services. Now, Homeless Persons Health Project and your own work, Steve, as a needle exchange, is a significant harm reduction service
in the
community.
Yeah.
Shelter is a vital service, and that, of course, is not being provided and has not increased in 15 years, as far as I've seen. You and I had a little kind of exchange about this. You feel that the number of homeless people in town is dropping, and that's somehow significant. I kind of doubt that, and you say, bring me the figures, and I'm still, you know, scampering to try to find you the figures to back up my propaganda.
Having brought figures of my own to back up my propaganda.
You brought your homeless census figures from 2009.
An interesting point,
but the issue is... go back to the Monica Martinez stuff and the meeting on Tuesday, because I want you to report on that meeting.
And the issue is that there was a conspicuous lack of mention of any... what the number of spaces were available, how many people were needing those spaces, whether or not we were going to have more space available for people, whether or not they were doing anything to generate additional service of people, additional shelter for people. Those things were all conspicuously absent. I think that they need to be part of the discussion always. Now we have November, December coming on where they're going to be opening Armory. That's an additional 100 spaces, my understanding. That was tangentially referred to as, well, we're going to have more capacity, but not really what we're doing day-to-day to create more shelter for people. And that, I think, was not a part of that discussion.
It isn't even that, you know, I mean, this is the typical service provider, good boy, good time, good guy, smile-along rhetoric. An objective would say, well, we'll provide, we're trying to get more services for people, we're trying to get more shelter. That really isn't the issue for me. The issue for me is realistically speaking, A, how much shelter is there? B, what is the need? And so C, what do you do with the people who are, in fact, outside? Do you arrest them? Do you ticket them? Do you harass them? What is going to be the process for dealing with this? You know, you can, and obviously there's a segment of the community that wants to criminalize them and hopes that by creating very harsh laws, they can drive people out of town and create a de facto gated community. I think that seems to be my impression of your report on this particular meeting. You said there were about 40 or 50 people in the police community room.
In that neighborhood. Yeah.
And you had these long-time social service provider types like Don Lane and Catherine Byers of the city council. And you also had, I guess, probably had a few other people like Ron Pomerantz.
David Foster,
who are touting themselves as liberals in this race, and who you have been sympathetic to, particularly David Foster, as somehow worth a vote.
And yet neither have spoken out on homeless issues.
And neither even corrected the situation in terms of raising the issue of, a bunch of bigots are going to start getting even more aggressive unless you say to them, hey, guys, let's not get stupid here. People are going to sleep whether you like it or not. You want to run them out of town with guns just because they're poor and homeless?
Well, and the fact is that criminalizing homelessness in an effort to drive them out of town has simply failed by any objective standard. So how long can you pursue that policy without changing it?
And of course, what we need to do is actually see if there is factual data that shows criminalizing homelessness has not worked. I mean, I repeat that as you do. I am more of the mind that it is so immoral. If it did work, I would be opposed to it. And that would be my point. So in a way, it's not really relevant. It's relevant in one sense that it hasn't worked if it hasn't. Mm-hmm. But it's more relevant to me that fascism may work to provide more Lebensraum for some of the German people, but it, should we say, does so at a cost that I don't want to see happen, in spite of the fact that we know that Jews, homeless people, and Palestinians are the vermin of the earth, right?
I'm not certain I agree with that.
I don't think
so. One thing I did want to discuss with you, and interestingly enough, one of the emails that I had received
that was a joke,
was talking about our homeless program
joke.
In Santa Barbara. Now, did you read this, where they identified, interestingly, it's in the email, one of the Huff emails he sent, they are under some kind of a court decree to house 50 homeless people. And they identified them as the 50 homeless people most in need of shelter and services. And they're evidently under, it's part of the program. One of the folks came in from, you've heard of the group 1,000 Homes, I think it is. I thought when I originally read it, it was 1,000 or 100,000 homes. And when I originally read it, I thought it was 100,000 homeless. But anyway, it was one of these folks that is involved with the 10-year plan to end homelessness, which was a federal program that began in 2001.
It's a federal fantasy. I'm sorry, it's not a federal program. That's a bunch of horseshit.
Yeah, well,
it
was developed in 2001 to end homelessness in 10 years, and here we are in 2010. And how close do you think, Robert, we are to ending homelessness along that timeline?
It's a pretext that gives cities the opportunity to criminalize homeless people while at the same time claiming they are helping homeless people. And it is, it's Santa Cruz. I've often mocked Linda LeMaster, for example, a very articulate and intelligent and compassionate person who has been on our show repeatedly and has fought for decades and been herself homeless and fought for the rights of homeless people. She goes to the Continuum of Care, which has a new name now. I don't know what it is. A bunch of bureaucrats who meet once a week to, essentially garner grants for programs so that people can fight over little pieces of the pie while the military rolls on overseas and, the banks continue to, gobble up what remains of the pie, not just the banks. I don't want to just engage in Tea Party rhetoric.
No, I'd be interested in your reaction to that email. Maybe you can play one of your street interviews while we look that up or something, but I would be very interested in your reaction to that, which was in a Huff email that I received.
Okay, well, I'm going to actually look that up now. And while I'm doing that, let us indeed go to this is a street interview from mid-October, which I played last show, but unfortunately I found in reviewing the show, it didn't go out. That is to say, for some reason, it was completely blank. So I'm hoping that we will be more successful this time and actually be able to hear this particular interview. This is, I believe, well, let's see if we've got it. Let me play it, and then I'll see where we're at.
Here we are talking to that man about the streets in front of the Palomar on a foggy, overcast Friday, I guess we are.
And this is Ray, who is often he's an older guy in his 50s, a panhandler who sits in front of the Palomar until he's driven away by the move-along police with their stopwatches, who somehow claim that people have to move along every hour, which isn't true. They lie to the people who are panhandling to that effect, but they intimidate them, because who wants to question a police officer except the very bold or the people who actually have some solidarity with each other and will support each other, which, of course, is the point of this show. But let's hear some of this. This is Ray.
Around 2 o'clock in the afternoon, on October 15th, I believe.
The 15th, yes, you're right.
Could be the 15th. And you're here with your sign, Spare Change, Please Help, Thank You So Much, and Please Be Blessed.
With my little caterpillar. Don't forget the caterpillar. People can't see it.
You have a little caterpillar on that sign. The sign, of course, is leaning against a water bottle or some kind of a fruit bottle or a bottle that you have... put up here.
You're wanted, man. You're wanted in what, 50 states?
I'm unwanted in Santa Cruz.
You're wanted in 50 states, man. Unwanted.
All right.
How you doing, man?
I'm working on the old hoota hoota, you know.
You are?
Well, I'm interviewing this individual here. Any comments for Free Radio?
Hey, it's a great day, even though the sun's not shining.
And it's great because you've inherited $1 million, your house has not been repossessed. What's happening?
I just been out and about the town and enjoying Santa Cruz. I love Santa Cruz.
And we've been talking with?
Lance Leopold.
Of course. Thank you, Lance.
All right.
But getting back to you, Ray, that man about the streets who is often about the streets.
Often about the streets. Yes, I am, usually.
We have some frustration, Ray, that you've felt recently around Judges Proposition 36, which was the 2000 proposition passed that allowed people who have bogus, bullshit drug war convictions to hard drug convictions on their first offense to get drug diversion and treatment and all that kind of thing.
Yes. And, part of that was His Honor said that he wanted to see my proof of eligibility for GA, and I had an appointment for the 8th of October. When I got there, they said that they, and I had it on a piece of paper that came in the mail at 115 Coral, and when I got there, they said they didn't have anything, any record of me being scheduled for an appointment. That was the first thing. The second thing was I had to fill out all the paperwork over again. When I finally did get to see a worker...
Hold up, carry on, Ray.
So anyways, I finally get to see a worker. It's a little Oriental lady. Her name is Suze. And it seemed to me, I just got the impression that since it was Friday and things probably also, I was getting the bum's rush. Because she didn't bother addressing the fact that I was eligible for expedited food stamps. Also, there was another in fine print saying that I was eligible for $200 cash relief for anything from footwear to transportation to food, you name it. I guess it's just there.
They just had no record of you, in other words.
In other words, no. So she said that the last time, sometime in August, they reviewed it and I was denied GA. So I told her, well, I need this paperwork for the judge just to know that I'm eligible. It doesn't necessarily mean that you have to give it to me, just that I am eligible for it. I fall below the poverty level. And she said, well, that's impossible without you having an interview. And I said, well, when's my interview? And she said, well, she put me on a standby appointment for the 5th of November, propped up by...
But you won't be able to go there because you'll be in jail on a warrant.
Precisely. No, by that time I should be able to speak with the judge again, but he's going to be frustrated.
Which judge is it?
Yeah, it's Marigondo.
Oh, gag me.
Yes. Anyways, but he's been quite... like last time I missed court, I figured he was going to throw the book at me. He actually reduced my weekly meetings and gave me a month to get all this stuff, you know, taken care of. But, you know, and I missed court because I didn't get in to see the lady till 2 o'clock. And it's all just about rescheduling and all that happy kind of crap. But I could not believe that they just couldn't give me a slip of paper saying that I was below the poverty level, obviously, and that I could just present this to the judge. Instead, she gives me a standby appointment for the 5th of November, and then a solid appointment for sometime during the first week, I believe, in December.
Hold it. We have some unreasonably disturbing noise going by, but he didn't get a ticket. Oh, well.
That was the sound of Harley Davidson, their answer to the crotch rocket thing.
Indeed. Well.
Sport Bob or whatever they're called. But anyways, other than that, I've just been going about my business and, you know, trying to survive. I did, however, get a ticket yesterday for sitting here too long.
Oh, ho.
Yes.
Just I have to greet one of the passers by. Heil Rotkin.
Heil Rotkin.
Yes. He's not Rotkin. He's a sympathizer.
Yeah, he's a nice guy.
Yes.
But anyways... Officer Forbes.
Commie dog, you.
I like
this. Officer Forbes and another public safety officer in the light blue shirt.
This is danger, man.
It's doing good. I'm doing interviews. Would you like to be on the radio? What's your name?
Kitzel.
And why are you hanging out with this kind of riffraff?
We went to Brooklyn College together.
And then he became a psychotherapist and went mad. Isn't that what happened?
No. Then he became a computer programmer and went mad.
I see. But then he became a psychotherapist and became sane again?
I don't know. He just passed his madness on to others.
That's the way to do it. And, of course, you're referring to the very same
person standing here. Hey.
Your name for our records.
For the records. Charlie, hi, everybody.
Charlie.
You're going to do it. Overthrow the government before it eats your children.
Send some off to eat other children, actually.
Your words were never spoken.
Thank you both.
Well.
We've been talking with?
Gattel. Robert. Seems that they've had, like, KPFA programs. Are they having trouble with one?
Well, I've been having... My last Sunday show was about KPFA's suppression of community content.
Really?
And how there's a kind of a war at KPFA, a civil war between those who want to continue a sort of a more vanilla NPR approach.
Right.
And those
it's
who want to...
It's happening in the AI, too.
Yeah, yeah. That's what I hear. So that's what I understand is happening from my sources.
Thank you.
But getting back to the real voice on the street, the infamous Ray. You say you got a ticket yesterday?
Yes, for being
today.
Yesterday, for being in this spot too long, the two officers approached me from directly behind, and it was a guy in a light blue shirt who was seemed like a youngster because he had a hard time finding the number of the
appropriate code section.
Yes, and his friend Officer Forbes was more than helpful, getting him to find the appropriate code for sitting in one spot longer than an hour. And when they approached me, they asked me how long I'd been here, and then the other guy said, has it been longer than an hour? And I said, well, it probably was longer than an hour, but I wasn't really sure. And they said, no, you know you've been here longer than an hour, so because you lied to us now, we're going to give you a ticket. I was just going to give you a warning, but now
just
I'm going to give you
a moment. You cannot be given a ticket unless you are given a warning and then refuse to move. Let me read the actual code section for those naive members of our audience who are tricked by Officer Forbes in this issue. Can you hold my papers for a moment, please? I'm opening up the sacred municipal code sections involved. And what do we find? Let's just take a peek, shall we?
So they have something to do during the day? So
they are doing it in order to purge the downtown of the, shall we say, beggars that are hanging out around here, terrorizing the merchants.
Well, then they should probably do away with the little statue of the man playing the saw. And
No. They want to pretend that they are liberal, but actually they don't want to actually be liberal. I mean, all right, now let's look at it here. It's 5.40.
You'd have to wear all that hemp clothing and everything.
Here we go, 5.40.020. And this is, no person shall allow a display device to remain on the same location on the sidewalk for a period of time exceeding 1 hour. After 1 hour, the person who placed the display device shall not place the device, so forth and so on. No person shall be cited under this section unless he or she has been notified by a police officer, public officer, or downtown host that he or she is in violation of the prohibition on this section, and thereafter continues the violation.
Oh, so they should have warned me first.
They gave you, in other words, next time it happens, say, take me to jail, and then sue their asses. That's my advice.
That's a good idea. That also explains the strange behavior of a couple of officers who came by and said, I'm giving you your 1 hour time check.
Mm-hmm.
And then actually, we would look at the clock and it would say, like now, it says 2 o'clock. So then they wouldn't bother me for another hour. They were actually...
But they are still required to come back. Notifying you before the hour starts is not adequate. They have to come back when the hour is over and then notify you.
Oh, really?
I believe so. Of course, you have to look at the wording of this code section.
Well, that's the whole thing. I mean, that's the whole problem with the whole thing. I mean, it's like all these little things and you almost need a lawyer.
That's the point, my boy. These are made for the people who are, shall we say, have enough means to hire attorneys. You, on the other hand, you can fly south or crawl south for the winter. You know what I mean?
Yes, that would be it.
And actually, I'm trying to see if they have to warn you before or after. You have to, yes, been notified that in violation of the prohibition. No, you can't be in violation of the prohibition until an hour is up.
Oh.
And therefore, they have to notify you you're in violation of the prohibition, and therefore, they have to do it after the hour is up.
Oh.
In other words, we have horseshit city.
So he just can't come up and just say, oh, you've been here longer than an hour, I'm giving you a ticket.
Correct.
But they're using, they're doing that. They can do that, of course, and give you a ticket anyway. Then what you do is you, the best thing to do is say, well, officer, take me to a magistrate if it's during court hours.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And then you take the magistrate and you show them, you say, look at the code section. I was not in violation of the section. The officer is in error. Or you can go further and you can say, officer, how would we do it? Let's see. You can say, first of all, you don't sign the ticket initially, but you say, I'm not refusing to sign the ticket. I just want to be taken to a magistrate first to see if there's probable cause.
Yes.
They may then say, well, we're taking you to jail instead because they're closed. And you might say, okay, well, that's fine if you're willing to deal with it at night in the pokey.
Yeah. You know. I hear they're very overcrowded over there right now.
Right, well, then they let you out at 4 in the morning without any clothes or without a lot. Maybe take your property, put it in the police lockup so you can get it 4 days later.
Yes.
During the specified half hour to 1 hour time on Tuesday or Thursday.
Yes, that's the other problem I have is getting there. That's where my good backpack is, all my art supplies and my one good wool blanket is still in police lockup because, like you said, you've got a time frame you have to follow. You have to be there precisely at, I recommend to be there 5 minutes early. Have your S number ready, and be ready to get on the phone.
12:30 to 1:30, and I think it's 3:15 to 3:30 Tuesdays and Thursdays.
It's a very minute amount of time they give you. It's like not even a half an hour.
A false arrest is a false arrest. If he arrests you and you lose time and property, you have to sit down afterward and write down everything you remember about what he said to you, what property you had, and were inconvenienced in not having access to.
Yes.
You want to prove, then you want to take him to small claims court if you can't get an attorney. Of course, that means.
Because, well, like right now, okay, my paperwork I need to show the judge is in my small backpack. Now, if I was to be arrested on a warrant for not appearing in court and have to wait to go back to court, I would need these papers to show the judge. Unfortunately,
every Tuesday and Thursday you can pull them out if you're there at the right time, if they happen to be able to find them.
Yes, but if I'm in jail and court is on Friday, then
wait till the next Tuesday or Thursday, or perhaps a year from Tuesday or Thursday.
Probably,
perhaps.
Yes. The wheels of justice do turn slowly. Hey, here's a little levity for you. What if John Wayne was a stand-up comedian? Well, a guy walks into a doctor's office with a duck on his head. Wah! The doctor says, "Can I help you?" And the duck says, "Yeah, can you get this guy off my ass?" Wah!
Wah! Ha! And that is it from Uncle Ray here on the sidewalk. Anything else?
No, just everybody be well and peace out and have a good, lovely day. And I hope the sun starts shining again sometime between now and December.
The sun ain't gonna shine anymore.
Don't say that.
I won't.
Thank you.
I'll
very
take
much.
That back. Hold on. You on the subject. We're talking with.
Before we go on to the next speaker. Ray, I ran into the next day or two, and he was actually sitting in another spot instead of at his usual place, and he told me that he had moved because he saw some police officers looking at him. So not only did they have to come up, once having been given a false ticket by Officer Forbes and or his young sidekick, that is to say, being given a ticket for not having moved along, even though he's not supposed to be given a ticket unless he refuses to move along after having been warned that he's been there for more than an hour. According to, if Ray's account is correct, he was told, when asked, have you been here more than an hour? He said, I don't think so, or I'm not sure. And he said, oh, you're lying to us, so we're giving you a ticket. That is an illegal ticket, and you might call it even further unconstitutional harassment and the assertion of unjust authority, which, of course, is nothing new on Pacific Avenue, but it's always good to document it when it happens. And the proper procedure for the police is to say, you know, you've been here for an hour, we checked you out, move on or get a ticket, at which point Ray would have picked up his ass and moved along because, unlike, say, Steve Argue 7 years ago, your namesake, who was also running for city council in the old days, who said, sorry, I have a First Amendment right to be here. You know, bust me if you wish. Shoot if you must this old gray head, but spare your country's constitution.
Was he also successful in his effort to...
He was successful in getting the charge dismissed.
Was
however,
he successful
never,
in his...
He did not go to small claims court.
Did he go to city council?
Did he
win a seat on the council?
No, but he got thousands of votes, probably more than you'll get, because he was an advocate for a very outspoken leftist position on a number of issues, although you do seem to be somewhat... out of the mainstream and into the justice stream on the homeless issue, as I might put it. So for those who are interested in talking to this, the very honorable Steve Plate.
For city council.
Why do I say Plate? I guess it's because of flying saucers. Who knows?
No, you're doing better than Sleepy John did. He kept calling me Steve Plate-ya.
Pleccia.
Ah, Steve Pleccia. He's an Italiano. He's a Sleepy John. Yeah.
The second show, he finally got it right.
So. That's good. Well, Steve Pleccia, as not Pletch, which it looks like, but Pleccia. So if you actually see him on the ballot, it's Pleich, but it's pronounced Pleich. Probably they should have changed his name when he entered the country, but then again, he was always been in the country, so that couldn't have been done.
If you see me on the street, don't hesitate to come say hello.
If I say that again?
If you see me on the street, any of my supporters, anybody listening here, don't hesitate.
Yeah, take a look at his profile. You can see him here in the studio. He's looking pretty good. How would we describe him? Silver-maned, smooth-cheeked, tall, virile, works out every day at the gym, sexually potent. We don't want to go into that.
And it's been referred to as a very good-looking man.
A very good-looking man.
Not as good-looking as, of course...
Robert Norris. Yes, no. Robert Norris, of course, takes the cake.
Well known.
They call him Old Wrinkle Face. But we won't get into that. Anyway, the phone number here, should you decide to call in to chat with us about any of these issues, 427-3772. If you want to support Free Radio by checking out the benefit, Saturday night, 6 to 9 at 316 Main Street. That's the Chavez House. It's going to be a benefit with, I don't know who's going to be playing, but there's some interesting-looking drawings on this little ad. So maybe there'll be some bands. Maybe there'll just be somebody telling old jokes about ducks on people's heads. Who knows?
Could be.
I think that joke could be improved by talking about... Mike Rotkin walked into a psychiatrist's office, but I'll have to work on the Rotkin's going out of office. We've got to, we're considering a whole new crop of gangsters on the Gang of Seven. Gangster meaning not necessarily people who are engaged in explicit extortion, although some say that the rental inspection ordinance is a form of extortion, perhaps, passed this summer by the city council. But let's just say the Gang of Seven, as we used to call the city council 20 years ago, and kind of hearkening back to the 70s Gang of Four in China, for those of you who have long historical memories. For those of you who don't, time to read up on Chinese history. But Steve has brought up the issue of Santa Barbara and something he saw on the Huff email list. The Huff is Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. Huff, you can get on the Huff email list. It has local and national, sometimes international stuff about mostly civil rights concerns of homeless people and the struggle to restore rights to homeless people in Santa Cruz. There was a, I don't know if this particular article was on, but perhaps it was, certainly the same subject. Could the 100,000 homes campaign work in Santa Barbara? Now, since this is radio, I'd like to find, it'd be nice if there were a radio clip, but it doesn't look like there is, so instead you get to hear me reading the clip. Reading this particular story.
You can summarize it, probably.
Let's see. Will Common Ground, the nonprofit famous for sweeping surprising numbers of chronically homeless persons into housing in efficient bursts of community activism, that's the first I've heard of that, but maybe it's true, be working its magic in Santa Barbara, where actually I worked for a full year at a paid job as a homeless advocate, believe it or not, for the Legal Defense Center back then.
I believe it.
In the early 90s, yeah. That's the question South County homeless advocates and service providers have been asking each other since Friday when Becky Canis, director of Common Ground's 100,000 Homes campaign, visited Santa Barbara. While she was here, she met with a contingent of government officials, as well as Mike Fuller, co-director of the 10-year plan to end chronic homelessness.
How's that 10-year plan going?
Indeed. How's it working for you?
Yeah.
And Rob Pearson, director of the Housing Authority of the City of Santa Barbara. What exactly was said in the meeting is unknown at this point. Doesn't sound good. However, as the city compiles its list of the 50 most vulnerable homeless people, as required in the legal settlement with the American Civil Liberties Union, it also must consider how to offer these 50 housing, because that is part of the settlement, too. If enough community-based homeless organizations put their enthusiasm behind bringing 100,000 homes to Santa Barbara, it's possible that the campaign will be a part of the city's progress in getting its 50 most vulnerable into homes. Was there something in particular you wanted me to...
I was just curious about how their efforts in Santa Barbara contrast to our efforts here, might be applied to our efforts here. What are they doing down there that has seeming success in terms of combating a camping ban, evidently, that they had as one of their ordinances. Just the application of their strategies, maybe, to what we're doing here.
Well, here's an article which I haven't read, and so this is going to be kind of new to me. Whatever happened to that ACLU lawsuit? And this is from the Weekly in Santa Barbara, the Santa Barbara Independent, which is a little better, and it's hard to be worse, than the Good Times or the Santa Cruz Weekly.
Oh, my.
The one that had your picture in
That's
the paper, I believe.
Truly damning one by faint praise.
Damning by, I'm trying to be actually, accurate critique.
Well, yes. That would be a refreshing change.
I will ignore that statement. Mm-hmm. Isabel T. Walker wrote, remember March 6, 2009, the sunny morning when the ACLU announced from a De La Guerra Plaza that it was suing the city of Santa Barbara for having laws illegalizing sleeping and camping in public? Have you ever wondered how that lawsuit was resolved or if the fanfare changed anything for homeless people who must sleep outside here? Yes.
And actually, I'm wondering.
I'm also wondering. The dispute was settled, actually. It was settled last summer on August 24th, 2009, 1 year ago this week. Apparently, this article was written on August 27th, 2010.
But still not in the distant past. Pretty recent.
Pretty recent. Basically, the ACLU agreed to drop the dispute if the city did the following three things. One, foster with both financial and planning assistance the construction of between 105 to 115 units of supportive housing for very low or just plain low-income people and families, 63 units of which must be ready for occupancy by December 2011. Two, facilitate the coordination of street outreach teams operating here and encourage the 10-year plan, a.k.a. bringing our community home, so they can all collaboratively work to identify chronically unsheltered, I'm getting lost in the rhetoric here,
yeah,
homeless people and, when possible, steer them into housing and employment. As part of this, the settlement demanded that the city compile a list of 50 of the most chronically homeless people within its boundaries and give them first dibs on the newly constructed supportive housing units.
We can compile such a list. We're probably within a mile of here.
And then three, lastly, after developing this list of 50, the city attorney's office must create a program to avoid arresting and prosecuting anyone on it who is disabled for violations of the no sleeping and no camping laws unless they've been offered housing and refused it. In a nutshell, these are the things the ACLU demanded from the city exchange for dropping its suit, which it did. A year has passed. The city how is the city progressing on the bargain? To read more, go to homelessnesssantabarbara.org. And we just did that, and I will actually give people further updates in shows to come. And again, just Google for homeless in Santa Barbara ACLU lawsuit. It's interesting that the disabled issue is a significant hook on which to catch up the city attorney's attempts to criminalize homelessness. So, for instance, the issue can become whether national disability laws are being violated through criminalizing homeless people who are disabled.
I mean, I'm not telling you anything, and I'm certain that you know, but the HUD definition of homelessness is an unaccompanied disabled single adult. So there is a disability element to the HUD definition of homelessness, and maybe that's what they're applying there. I'm just thinking that there are some striking similarities that city attorneys involved there. There's a homeless situation that people are trying to resolve. There's ACLU has apparently brought some pressure to bear or been able to obtain some kind of a decree or a judgment of some kind that's forced the city to do something. All I'm wondering is whether or not any of those strategies have been considered.
Well, it's interesting. Normally I have people, I have sources down in Santa Barbara, for instance. I emailed recently a homeless activist down there called Nuff Said, as I call her, Nancy McCready, who has been a longtime homeless advocate and leader of protests and so forth down there, as well as a poverty pimp confrere who kind of hangs out with the service providers and gets some funding through them. He tries to play both sides of the street and, does some good, and I feel some things that aren't so good. But she pointed out that we were talking about that 647E lodging law, which is what our own homeless people are charged with, who fought in struggled for the Peace Camp 2010's attempt to turn back the sleeping ban law in Santa Cruz. And she and I, for that matter, were arrested under that ordinance years ago, and we beat it back. And as I understand, John Valley beat it back
some days ago. He said this to me yesterday, as I mentioned to you at the Huff meeting. As I said, John Valley is a disabled guy, now that we're talking about disabled people. Mm-hmm. He's in a wheelchair. He actually called the ambulance. He had a heart attack or some such thing while we were in front of the county building. He was part of the Peace Camp 2010 protest. Really messy, spread his stuff all over the place, gruff, growling, but also, if he wants to be, very articulate. And
that could describe several people in this room.
Perhaps. But he, more so than in a much more overt kind of way, in a much more visible way, because he's homeless, and you and I are not. And so he told me that he had, as his defense lawyer for the 647E tickets, which is the state penal code against, quote, lodging, which is the pretext that sheriff's deputies used to break up the Peace Camp 2010, you can't lodge, which means you can't sleep. It's an anti-sleeping law. But apparently, public defender Minsloff, according to John Valley's account, walked into the arraignment and said, lodging involves having some kind of a structure. There's no structure. There's no lodging. Dismiss this case. And maybe the judge just wanted to dismiss the case when faced with Minsloff and a disabled guy, mm-hmm. and he dismissed it. So we have it's significant in Santa Cruz because we have a bunch of 647E cases coming up for people like Curb Hugger Chris, who had a warrant out for his arrest, and Artful Art, and Gregarious Gary, and Linda Lemaster, and Ed Fry himself, and Tough It Out Todd. A whole bunch of people, myself know and you know, but we're sympathetic and we talk about it and write about it, who all face 647E charges. That's a misdemeanor. It's punishable by it's either 6 months or a year in jail, up to $1,000 fine. It's a nasty thing, but it does allow you a jury trial and an appointed public defender, which sleeping ban, which a lot of people got a lot of tickets on, the municipal code does not. And therefore, you're more likely, ironically, to get justice under the harsher charge, in my view, mm-hmm. than you are under the infraction charge.
Well, there's certainly a stricter scrutiny about the justiciability of those kinds of charges whenever you have a fundamental right that's being challenged, loss of liberty, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. Now, they don't promise you happiness, but they do promise you that you can pursue it. But when there is a loss of liberty, and misdemeanors do involve a loss of liberty, that rises to a different standard. I think maybe the courts take a somewhat more serious look at that than they might otherwise. Also, those kinds of things are subject to review, and judges at any level don't like to be overturned. So maybe chances of, because it is a harsher charge, getting perhaps more of a fair hearing seem reasonable.
And it'll be interesting to follow because I know Linda said she met with her public defender yesterday, and her public defender is planning what he calls a demurrer that will challenge the constitutionality of the law, which is kind of a strange approach on a demurrer, but maybe not. And that's coming up in November, and so maybe we can follow that more closely. But the issue here about the ACLU's backing down on a lawsuit with the promise of some supportive housing, to me, misses the issue, certainly misses the issue that Ed Fry was raising, which is actually a broader issue. My issue has been, if you haven't got shelter, you don't arrest people for sleeping outside because they have to sleep. His issue is, unless there's a health and safety concern or somebody's rights are violated, some victim is involved, you don't arrest someone for sleeping outside, period, even if there is shelter available and even if they refuse it, which I think is, and it's also an argument I agree with. So that issue, both those issues are at stake in the ACLU lawsuit in Santa Barbara, the ACLU lawsuit in Santa Monica, the ACLU lawsuit, I don't know if it's ACLU, but Mark Maron's lawsuit in Sacramento, the successful ACLU lawsuit in Laguna Beach, and, of course, the successful settlements, somewhat successful settlements, in Los Angeles in the Jones settlement and in San Diego in the Spencer settlement. And
so conspicuous by the enumeration of all those cities is Santa Cruz.
By its absence, yes. Santa Cruz has neither a settlement nor an active lawsuit.
It does, however, as you and I have been discussing, has had a change in the law recently, which you apparently chatted with the city attorney about today.
I didn't get a chance to chat.
He was busy.
But
dear.
How did that happen? We'll be chatting in the near future.
In the near future. You and John sitting down with a little wine and cheese at the Soif restaurant.
A little brie, a little something crisp and white.
A little something. A little Beaujolais.
Maybe perhaps. I can invite him to join the Robert Norris Christmas Chorale.
Along
with Drum Circle Dave and Bob Patton. We've got four now.
Well, I'll keep a safe distance from that particular group. In any case, Barisoni is our city attorney. He did cook up a law, which he either presented in June, if you believe Catherine Byers, or later, if you believe what I think is more likely, but I have no evidence for, the Peace Camp 2010 pressure, that changed the Municipal Code 6.36, the camping ordinance, and specifically impacts the sleeping ban. Well, it also impacts the blanket ban and the whole camping ban, too. But it says if you're on a waiting list at the time of a citation, then you can have the citation dismissed. Because that really means implicitly there's no shelter if you're on the waiting list. I suppose it might mean there is shelter if you went to somewhere else, but they're really very limited shelter. And we've been pointing out repeatedly.
Well, and to me, this is like straining at the gnat and swallowing the camel. You know, if you're going to go ahead and amend an ordinance, then in my mind, you should just repeal it. There should be no sleeping ban or camping ban. But if you're going to amend it in any marginally positive way, then go ahead and do that. You know, don't make it implicitly more difficult for them to do it. It's basically an exercise in futility. So, okay, you know, there's no shelter. Rather than just admitting there's no shelter and not issuing any tickets, you know, you have to get on a waiting list, and then you have to actually get a ticket, and then you have to go over and have it dismissed. If you can show evidence that there's shelters were full and you're on a waiting list, it's just, this is nonsense. And, you know, my position is that there should be a more straightforward procedure that when there is no shelter, and in Santa Cruz there is not enough shelter for people, they should simply not issue tickets.
Right, and that's Ed Fry's position, too, and that's, I think, any reasonable person's position, frankly, who isn't a part of the mob that you were in the midst of on Tuesday night at the Santa Cruz Neighbors Forum on Homeless Services in the police department's community room.
Adrift in a sea of opposing views.
Any other comments about that particular session with the service providers?
I think I was a little surprised to kind of at the
vehemence?
The vehemence was the word I was going to use, but I was trying to find a better one, of the people who were speaking against homelessness generally. You know, their attitude.
Against homelessness or against homeless people?
Against homeless people.
Well, I think we're all against homelessness in the sense that you shouldn't be an involuntary status you're forced to have. But there are a lot of people who are, I think, blaming homeless people and blaming homeless services for creating or enabling homeless people.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the points that was made later in the forum was a lady was sitting right next to me. She says, well, after Monique Martinez had recited this litany of all the good things they're doing, you know, last month we provided 25,000 showers and we provided washers and dryers for 6,000 loads of laundry and stuff. So the lady sitting next to me says, well, and then they served 10,000 meals or something. And the lady sitting next to me says, well, so what you're saying is that anybody's free to kind of live anywhere they want to in Santa Cruz, and when they need a shower or when they need to do their laundry or when they need to eat a meal, we're going to provide it for them. We're just going to enable their behavior being homelessness for those folks who just don't want to live anywhere but outdoors and by themselves and free. And there wasn't really any satisfactory answer to that, because what do you say to that?
Yeah, there is an answer to that. The answer to that is no, actually, these services were set up because merchants were upset that homeless people were downtown protesting the criminalization of people who were being driven out of town, beaten, harassed for engaging in the same kind of constitutional behavior that house people do in their homes.
And had you been there to give that response, then it would have been aired. I think that's fair. But this lady obviously doesn't have the historical perspective or knowledge, maybe, that you do.
But Catherine Byers and Don Lane do. And I would also hope that Ed Fry does. But, of course, the problem is it was not set up so that ordinary people in the audience would say
it. And had they your clarity of purpose, perhaps they would have risen to their feet.
Perhaps. I don't think I would have risen to my feet necessarily in a group of that kind. Because, but I think if we'd had a, you know, just like tonight, it would have been nice if Huff had people to go out to the board of directors
meeting
and say to Monica Martinez, come on, Monica, you know,
Do it. What will help homeless people in their next protest, which is issue statements that we've gotten in the shelter.
I mean, when you were at the board of directors, did you get any sense of what the board feels about their own
policies? Yeah, they all like
policies?
To think they're the liberalist people in town, and we can work it out with the police department. And sure, we don't have any shelter, and we don't mind saying that, but you try to get them to do it, and they don't do it. So that there is many a slip, you know, twixt the what is it, the nose and the lip, or whatever.
Yeah, of course, the cup and the lip.
Thank you so much. Yeah. Never too good at those epigrams. So, I mean, if for all of you potential activists out there who want to assist, we need people who want to, if not just, you know, be feet on the ground and bodies in the mass, people who want to do some writing on these issues, people who want to write letters, people who want to attend court and watch what's going on, people who want to do research, assist in making connections with organizations in other cities, call HUFF, 423-4833, 423-HUFF, H-U-F-F, and I will assign you a job to do.
And as dreary as court attendance can be, I think it is important. You know, it is important for people to be there to let the judicial system know that there are people who are concerned and activist about the issue.
Well, yeah, it's not just to, you know, make the judges nervous. It's also to write letters to the Commission on Judicial Performance. It's also to give out little flyers to people in the hallway that says, disqualify this judge because she is prejudiced on the following grounds. It's also to distribute jury nullification literature, which, of course, may put you in jail. Who knows? But it's important that we attempt to recapture the institutions of American government that have gotten away from us. And there are some who say, well, all you got to do is vote for the Democratic Party and you're on your way.
Well, as you pointed out, the difference between the litigant and the activist is sometimes the activist does have to go to jail.
Or risk going to jail. It's not so much people want to go to jail. It's a real waste of time.
Who wants to, Robert? Of course they don't.
Ah, right.
But sometimes, you know, you have to make that kind of sacrifice. You have to make that kind of commitment to what you're doing.
Yeah, you have to say, if you're going to take me to jail, take me to jail. Because at that point, the police officer then has to decide what he's going to do. And sometimes, a number of times, he makes the right... Sometimes you help him to make the right choice. Mm-hmm. Or if he makes the wrong choice, you can expose it in a way that will make sure that that doesn't happen again to the next five people. Now, so, and then another 60% of the time, you get screwed. So, I mean, you know, there is a cost to this, too. We're not, like, pretending it's, you know, an easy thing to do or a sure thing to do. It isn't. It takes a belief that it's worth your time, that there's somehow, you know, that somewhere, at some point in history, someone is watching and it has some kind of impact. And sometimes it doesn't, you know. I mean, that's also true.
So now you were saying that, of course, you were working as an activist for homelessness for the homeless in Santa Barbara. Are you still in contact with those people at all? Or?
Well, I'm in contact with some of the people I met down there, and the people I was working for are long since retired. It was like 17 years ago, in 19 and 18 years ago, 92 and 93, and somewhat in 94, when I was arrested for serving free food in San Francisco and tried, a lot of the attorneys down there wrote letters, you know, commending my character, and we even convinced the district attorney in San Francisco to go into court and say, well, I don't want anything brought against this guy. But the judge, Judge Barkley, who had been brought out from out of town because I was part of Food Not Bombs, and Food Not Bombs was something that the institutional structure of San Francisco hates, no question about it. They have beaten up the head of Food Not Bombs, a dozen times, sent him in the hospital, half a dozen
Kevin
times.
Kevin McHenry you're talking about?
Keith McHenry. That's
okay.
Correct, yeah, yeah, for sure. And he is actually, he's still continuing to fight the good fight, and he's a friendly, articulate, lovable character, and...
That's another thing that was in one of the HUFF emails, that there was an interview with...
Yeah, HUFF's got some good stuff on it. I encourage people to sign up for the HUFF email list. If you give a call to 423-HUFF or email me at rnorse3@hotmail.com, I will put you on.
And
the
just
HUFF
as somebody
email,
who is
rnorse3,
who is new to the HUFF email and actually, you know, relatively new to the movement, HUFF email is an extremely valuable source of information of the living history of kind of finding out where people have been and are going to, in the struggle to find shelter for people. I found it to be extremely informative, and it gives me a better sense of what people are really concerned and what people care about.
And that's Steve
Plaich for city council, for those who have forgotten his name like me. So
and I'm sitting right next to the guy.
So. You know, another group that's doing some hard work is the Fresno homeless activists, particularly Mike Rhodes, who I've had on my show by phone a number of times. He and others, his daughter, particularly Simone Rhodes, that goes to UCSC here, were able to successfully get a $2.3 million lawsuit against the city of Fresno, won by homeless people. The issue was the theft of homeless property, which, of course, is a big problem in Santa Cruz as well, particularly for political activists around Peace Camp 2010. And by the way, for those of you attorneys listening, one of our activists, Gary, is looking for an attorney. And if anybody wants to be a volunteer attorney for Gary, give a call to 423-HUFF, and I will put you on to Gary. Gary Johnson, his name is, and he was probably one of the longest, most persistent sleepers outside the county building and outside City Hall during the Peace Camp 2010 protests. And he's now facing many charges of sleeping, all of which should be dismissible, as far as I'm concerned, with the necessity defense. But you never could tell what these clowns are going to do.
So he's kind of the current tip of the spear.
He's one of them. And yeah. I know that he's currently being represented by Ed Fry, but Ed has just got too many people to do what needs to be done in this case, which is essentially to expose the whole series of measures taken by the city to criminalize this protest, which included Klieg lights, selective enforcement of laws, creation of new no forbidden zones where people couldn't be suddenly at the drop of a hat in an illegal manner, such as closing off the city hall grounds at night, making it illegal to sit on the benches across the street, ticketing the porta potty. I mean, they did it, ticketing people for sleeping on the sidewalk, claiming they were obstructing the sidewalk at 3 in the morning, when they weren't. It's just a whole systematized attack on a protest orchestrated by city manager Martine Bernal, Mayor Mike Rotkin, police chief, acting police chief Kevin Vogel, and probably a few other of these highly paid city officials who were engaged, as far as I'm concerned, in a conspiracy to violate the civil rights human beings here.
It might be unfair to lay that at Kevin Vogel's doorstep right now. I think that's the legacy of Howard Scarry. Our Juice Beats and Retired Chief.
But
let's give Kevin Vogel an opportunity to get his feet on the ground and see what's going on before we are accusing him of things that we really can't
say. My problem with Kevin Vogel is, and I've talked to you about this before, and I've probably discussed it on the air, is even though I personally like the guy, and I will give him credit for actually having been candid with us as a police officer a decade ago in actually naming names of political figures who were responsible for unconstitutional activity and trying to involve him in unconstitutional activity, which I've talked about on the air before, in the case of Keith Sugar in the James Ney arrests at City Council, where Sugar pointed out James Ney, the activist, and said to Kevin Vogel, who was then a sergeant at City Council, arrest him when I give the signal. That was what Kevin Vogel told us later was the case. And I thought that was maybe he didn't like Sugar much, and that was one of the reasons he did it. But the fact of the matter is, it was, I think, kind of a risky and a ballsy thing to do. But since then, Vogel has gotten much worse, because it seems the higher he's climbed in the chain of command, the worse he's gotten. I mean, the big thing was, of course, the DIY last night political surveillance of the group that planned the New Year's Eve walk. And that, not only did he create that whole mess by assigning people to go undercover to investigate it, but he also, you know, claimed that he was going to investigate himself and give himself a clean bill of health, which he did. I didn't claim he'd do that. He just did it. I mean, it's hard to believe that an individual who has any sense of propriety or even common sense around these issues would allow this to happen. And I've also had personal problems with Kevin, not because I don't like him and he doesn't like me. We've chatted with each other recently, you know, in civil terms. But he allows his underlings, Tricia Husom, the records manager, to deny me access to public records because I insist on going into the police station with a tape recorder and saying, I'm going to document what I'm doing. I have a right to record this as a public transaction.
If you don't like it, don't say anything. Just hand me the damn documents. And she apparently has either instructed or guards her staff and stopped them from providing me the public records that I've, that they've said are available.
But you're not certain what it is, whether or not she's instructed or whether or not
I asked Kevin Vogel to reassure me that when I walked into the police station, he would direct her to give me the damn documents. And all he said was, come to the police station. And I said, I don't want to come. I want you to reassure me that is going to happen. And he wouldn't. So he took, as far as I'm concerned, I have problems with acting police chief Vogel. But the issue here is not really Vogel. It is this coalition of people who have decided it's okay to eliminate the civil rights, not just of homeless people on a day-to-day basis or a night-to-night basis, but those who are standing up, housed and homeless alike, to protest and engage in legitimate political protest at City Hall and at a county building. And that is the problem, I think, that we have. So
that's the problem as you perceive it.
For sure.
At any rate, yeah.
For sure. I mean, if you perceive it differently, please tell me.
Not certain how I perceive it. I don't have your experience. I don't think, a basis to really make a determination about it.
Okay. Well, hopefully you will at some point.
Yeah, well, I'll be around for a while.
But if you don't, you know.
I'm not going anywhere.
You have a right to your opinion, your endless schmoozing with my Monica Martinez.
I may just stay here for Uncle Dennis's show for another time. I may chatter with John Barisoni. I may move in right
your
here.
Your chit-chat with Don Lane.
This could be my new campaign headquarters.
I don't know about that. Anyway, in Fresno, as I said before, I mentioned that they were successful in a $2.3 million lawsuit. They are still trying to make sure that the city of Fresno, which has not enacted a camping ban, probably because of the legal focus on that. There's I got a recent email from Mike Rhodes, who actually puts it out on a longer list. There's some debate about why the city of Fresno should provide restrooms to the homeless, public services. It seemed like this would be rather obvious, but Santa Cruz has the same problem. There are no restrooms at night for homeless people, with the sole exception of the homeless service center's 24-hour bathroom, which is opened only because of the actions of now discharged homeless service center director Doug Loisel. The reason why the city of Fresno should provide basic public services, Mike Rhodes writes, to the homeless, like trash pickup, drinking water, and toilets, is because, and in Fresno you have to understand, there are homeless encampments that are under freeways that have been there for years, and they have not been cleared away, in part because of the successful court fight.
Well, also in part because geographically, if you've been to Fresno, it's just so spread out. The city limits.
It's way spread out. But they're
It's also got the canals running through it, and it's got a lot, you know.
Right, but they are under the freeways, and they're in areas which, I guess maybe it's that the redevelopment agency isn't interested in putting up chic new shops. Who knows? Why should this be done? Why should they provide trash, pickup, drinking water, and toilets? Because, A, it is the right thing to do. B, every other citizen in Fresno gets these services. C, not providing homeless people with basic public services creates a health hazard, not only for them, but for the entire community. And D, the city of Fresno has no intention of providing all or even a significant percentage of homeless people with housing.
They want to create the,
they want to create the illusion okay. that they are providing the homeless with housing without actually doing much. There are now five if you count Tool Shed City, major homeless encampments in downtown Fresno.
In downtown Fresno, really?
That's what it says. Wow. There are more chronically homeless people in downtown Fresno than when the homeless czar started his housing project. I'm now talking to people who are in the first wave to get an apartment from Greg Barfield. He's the homeless czar.
Hmm.
But they are now back on the street and homeless again. The city provided no help in addition to the housing, and most people need some kind of assistance to get their lives back together. It is not easy after living 5 to 10 years on the street to readjust to living in an apartment or a house. One of the people I talked to said she was evicted after living in an apartment for about a year, and the landlord is suing her for part of the rent. She said she was evicted after complaining about a cockroach infestation. And that's Mike Rhodes on why the city should provide toilets, sanitation, and water for the encampments. And that's, of course, what they should be doing here in Santa Cruz. Of course, they don't allow encampments. Instead, people run around hiding and crapping in the bushes
and
so forth.
And it seems obvious that that's a public health issue.
Of course.
Just similarly, I make the analogy to needle exchange. There are a lot of people who don't understand needle exchange, but it's a public health issue. So you have public health issues. You want to ensure public health for all your citizens. Then make sure that you have access to public facilities for all your citizens.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty straightforward. I don't think it's really that difficult to understand. An interesting issue coming up in San Francisco. We have about 10 minutes left in the show, and if you want to call in, you certainly can.
Now, where does the time go?
And the time just went. 427-3772 is the call-in number. We'll take your call. This is an article by Praveen Maiden from the Bay Citizen, What's Wrong with the Sitlai Campaign Story. And Sitlai is a law that essentially is the Santa Cruz sitting ban, although a more limited version of it in time and a more extensive version of it in place. Santa Cruz sitting ban only applies to downtown business and other business districts and beachfront districts. It makes it illegal for people to sit on the sidewalk within 14 feet of a building, 14 feet of a crosswalk, 14 feet of a kiosk, 50 feet of a change-making machine, 14 feet of a bench. It essentially rules out 95% of the sidewalk, is my crude estimate, throughout the city's business districts for homeless people to sit, or anybody to sit, legally. Even if they're not blocking anything, even if they're doing nothing wrong. In other words, that kind of innocent conduct has become a basis for criminalizing people. In San Francisco, it is being proposed as it was proposed to the Board of Supervisors, and they, far more liberal than the Santa Cruz City Council, said, forget it, we're not going to pass that. So Mayor Gruesome Newsom, who's kind of on the level of Mike Rutkin, who also came up to speak in favor of the San Francisco Sitlai law.
Is that right?
That is correct. And I spoke against it. Actually, I know KGO News or something called me, and Rotkin and I had a kind of a mini face-off this spring on that issue.
Thinking you were actually Rob Morse, the Chronicle
not
writer?
At all. And not,
okay,
no,
okay.
No. They know who I am.
All right. As do we all.
As do you.
Yes.
This is an article by a merchant who you would think would be a supporter of the Sitlai law. In San Francisco, it would provide, it would criminalize sitting on the sidewalk anywhere in the city between the hours, I think, of 7 a.m. and 9 p.m. during the day. So it's kind of a strange... It's clearly a commercially designed law to, run off the riffraff from
storefronts.
Anywhere
within the city?
Anywhere within the city.
And as you know, San Francisco, city and county, is the same.
The same thing. Yeah. They're coterminous, yeah, as we say in the business.
But 44 square miles, by the way.
Whoa.
Smallest county in...
Now, I think I'm right on that, but it certainly does cover the business districts at least. So let's go ahead with that.
All right.
Since I'm a resident and retail business owner in the Haight, you might think this article is yet another complaint about the homeless and that I'm going to implore you to vote in favor of Proposition L, also known as the Civil Sidewalks Law or the Sitlai Law. Many of my customers, friends, and neighbors have been rallying for the Sitlai Law for months. If the law passes at the ballot in the November elections, my retail business might benefit and there would be fewer hassles to deal with in my daily life. If I had stopped thinking at this point, I would have simply gone along with the overwhelming public opinion and voted for the Sitlai Law. I don't think, by the way, it's overwhelming, though the amount of money being spent by large real estate interests, apparently, strangely enough, is at about a level of 100 to 1. There's like, I don't know, $500,000, $200,000 to $500,000 being spent.
That would be significant.
Yeah, in favor of Sitlai, and I think $2,500 being spent against it. I would have simply gone along with the overwhelming public opinion and voted for the Sitlai Law, but I couldn't stop thinking because something was wrong with the story that was being told to justify the Sitlai Law. When I asked a few questions, I got a confusing barrage of claims and counterclaims, but not enough facts. To satisfy my curiosity, I decided to do a little research. One thing led to another, and before I realized it, I had embarked on a one-man mission to dig up obtuse legal documents, seek out experts from around the country, and research the topic more deeply than it had been covered by any media outlet so far.
Well, you could be brothers separated at birth with that description.
What I discovered is that the arguments for the Sitlai Law don't really add up.
Hmm.
The narrative being circulated by the Sitlai Law's political campaign has three major components. The first component is the statement of the current situation. Gangs of thugs are overrunning Haight-Ashbury and other parts of San Francisco, picking fights with residents, vandalizing businesses, spitting on kids, and taunting women and old people. Validation of this narrative comes from quotes by affected residents and merchants and media pictures of groups of dirty-looking street people camped out on sidewalks accompanied by scary-looking dogs. It all sounds and appears very evil. The second part of the narrative talks about residents and merchants asking the elected politicians and the police to help contain the terror on the streets, and leaders of the San Francisco Police Department expressing their helplessness due to the limitation in current laws. This is the problem statement. The last part of the narrative involves the proposed solution in the form of a new law which will enable our city's police officers to deal with the problem so we can feel safe walking and shopping in our neighborhoods. Taken together, these three components form the prevailing public story about the proposed CITLI law as it is being told and retold in numerous public conversations and media reports. Let's begin by examining the current situation in the Haight. Homelessness is a national problem and not unique to the Haight. What makes it more of an issue in the Haight is that it is hard to talk about it in abstraction. Like my neighbors, I too am confronted by the sights, smells, and actions of the homeless people every day. A few of them appear drunk or on drugs. Some seem mentally ill, and others appear to be just hanging out. Their behavior ranges from quiet introversion to loud exhibitionism. Routinely, I am asked for spare change and leftovers. Sometimes I am offered buds, and practically every day, I have to make my way around a group of homeless people who are blocking my way on a sidewalk. Rampant panhandling, pot smoking, and drunken behavior are on exhibition by some of the homeless people blocking our sidewalks and sleeping in our doorways. These people pose a sensory challenge to our civilized sensibilities. They look dirty, smell terrible, and often say offensive things. If a few homeless people are huddling together in a pack with a fierce-looking dog and talking loudly, it appears like a riot is about to break out. But the problem with the CITLI campaign story is that I don't see any riots. I don't see the homeless people assaulting residents, vandalizing businesses, or creating a public safety hazard. I agree the Haight seems to have more than its fair share of homeless people, dog poop, and graffiti. But most of the homeless people are harmless. To the best of my knowledge, in the entire 3 years we have owned a retail bookshop on Haight Street, we haven't had a single incident where a homeless person has compromised the safety of anyone related to our business. In fact, it's rare to come across a homeless people who poses a real safety threat. The CITLI law campaign story is based on sweeping generalizations about the homeless people. The police chief refers to them as street thugs. The San Francisco Chronicle calls them bullies and punks. And the Wall Street Journal recently declared them to be gutter punks. The common thread here is the application of those vilifying labels to all homeless people, even if they are not hassling anyone or causing any problems. The word homeless by itself is a broad label which hides the underlying nuances of the labeled person's individual circumstances. Based on my conversations with dozens of homeless people, I have found that the group we refer to as homeless include a broad cross-section of folks ranging from disabled war veterans, kids who have run away from bad homes, or aged out of foster care system, artists and musicians traveling through this area while on their self-discovery journeys, and many others. Most of these people don't display the aggressive behaviors that seem to create, in the media at least, the illusion of a mob taking over our streets. Merchants and residents like me face some real challenges, but most have little to do with people squatting on sidewalks. The people shoplifting books and magazines in our bookstores are rarely the homeless. I have real experience in catching shoplifters in action and video footage from our security cameras to back this up. From my personal experience, it seems that the CITLI campaign is grossly exaggerating some problems and attributing others to the wrong set of people. I am not the only one who feels this way. In a recent meeting of Haight Street merchants, many of them voiced concerns that the CITLI campaign was creating a distorted and an unfairly negative picture of the historic neighborhood. And there is more to the story, but I have only 2 minutes left in my show, and I have a man in the studio who's prepared to bring you soothing music from the 60s to help remind you that we don't have to worry about 2010. We can drift back in time to a happier, simpler,
you
more diverse
era.
To
the Haight Street of the mid-60s?
The Haight Street of the mid, but not the late
60s. You think perhaps we could go from the cream to the dregs this evening?
We are going to go, and unfortunately, from the cream to the dregs. My show leads into Dennis' show, as I've often said and quipped on numerous occasions.
Uncle Dennis, who is my second favorite disc jockey in this entire station.
Indeed. And now, I want to point
What's
out...
your most favorite disc jockey?
For those who want to hear the rest of this story, since Uncle Dennis
I'm just interested.
Would not actually
allow us to continue this into his sacred program. What's wrong?
Robert,
what's wrong with the Sid Life?
For more than what, 7 hours a week.
We're
going to
hear the same tirade. What's wrong with the Sid Life campaign story is an article that can be found online. It's an go to www.baycitizen.org if you want to hear the rest of it. I may actually read the rest of it since it is a good article. And you actually, I think, could read this if you went on to the Huff email list, because I believe I sent it out earlier. But that's it for Bathrop Spears Broadsides tonight.
Thank goodness.
Coming up next is, of course, the irascible Uncle Dennis, who is not only preparing himself, but dropping pieces of paper on the ground, littering the very station he claims to help out. Pick up your trash, Uncle Dennis.
Will he be joining us for the Robert Norris Christmas Chorale?
You'll have to ask Uncle Dennis. If he is, I'm opting out. I can assure you of that.
Only if you'll pay my fine out of your trust fund.
Thank you for the famous fictional trust fund that I heard so much about. We will get into that one later. So I want to thank you all, those three listeners who have been listening.
All three?
Well, I want to thank
You're doing yourself tonight, Robert.
All three of you. I'm not sure how many, actually. There is a way that I could actually tell how many people are listening. Yeah. Dennis is going to show me how to look at the sad number of listeners who actually were listening to the show. Thank you, and I'll be back on Sunday with more of the same, 9:30 in the morning or possibly earlier if poor Thomas Levitt has... finds me in the studio, as he often does. And if you want to reach me off times, off air, and off kilter, you can call at 423-4833, which is where I can be found.
Find him wandering morosely down Pacific Avenue.
Indeed, with my tape recorder in hand, which is what I will be doing shortly. So that's it. Uncle Dennis, I'm afraid it's your show, much as I have to admit it. We're going to allow you an opportunity to... blast your sentimental nostalgia over the airwaves, however
soothing,
archaic it may
be.
Soothing, refreshing. Talk to you again on Sunday.
A song Dickie Best wrote from our second album, in memory of Elizabeth Reed.